very simple one, which is the chapter of the committee, because we have study leave. And so we'll also join us before the committee activities this week. Members, probably one last time this year, I'm going to ask that as any rules of the National Assembly, we elect for the day the acting chairperson to see us through the meeting. And with that simple intro, I'd like to call for nominations in that regard. Honorable Tliane.
Thank you very much. Would like to nominate Honorable Sheikh Qele as the acting chairperson of today's session.
Thank you. The nomination of Honorable M.A. Qele, MP, is noted. Is there a seconder for the nomination? Ms. Batsimli.
Thank you so much. I second the nomination of Honorable Qele.
Thank you. The nomination is seconded. Is there, are there any further nominations in that regard? In the absence of which, the Honorable M.A. Qele is duly elected acting chairperson for the day. Sir, if you may.
Good morning, honourable members. Good morning, Minister, Deputy Minister, and the team. Today, we are going to allow the Minister to do a briefing in two quarters, one and two. And he will do both, and then after that, we'll start engaging with them. Can I therefore make quickly, before Minister coming up, are there any apologies?
Acting Chair, the only apology is from Honourable Patrick Atkinson, who will be joining the meeting just a bit later.
Can you then allow the Minister to come and present these two quarters? Thanks.
Thank you very much, Acting Chairperson, and good morning to you and to the Honourable Members, Members of the Public and officials of the Department and of Parliament. Chair, if this was an international organization, we would be obliged to spend the first 5 minutes congratulating the Chair on his election. But given that it's a portfolio committee meeting, I think we can just say congratulations. Honorable Chair, thank you very much for the opportunity to the committee and to the members to account for the work done by the department. And I have been asked by Secretary of the Committee to present both Quarter 1 and Quarter 2, and following your direction, I will then deal with both sequentially. I'm going to perhaps spend a little bit more time in Quarter 2 because it's a more recent quarter, but I'll run briefly through the presentation on Quarter 1. Thank you very much, Chair, for that. Quarter 1 covers the period from April this year to the end of June. And what we're going to do is to highlight seven areas of work in the department, report on the KPIs, and then lay before the committee the report on human resources and finances. Commencing then, we're not going to deal with an economic and employment overview because that will come in the next quarter's presentation. In the highlights, we start first with a bit of work on trade that was done, covering the regional trade focus, in this case on Botswana. And slide 5 gives some key facts and figures on Botswana. It's the world's fourth largest rough diamond producing nation. And it holds a quite big part of the world's known reserves of diamonds, 18%. And it is the principal export of Botswana. If you think about it, 88% of all Botswana's exports is just in the form of diamonds. And their GDP has roughly doubled since 2001. Our GDP is 25 times that of Botswana's. But that that largely reflects the difference in size of population. Honourable members will see on the right-hand side, agriculture has declined as a percentage of GDP, as has manufacturing. Services has grown, and services covers just about everything. It's private services, government, construction, all of that is in services. Mining, interestingly, has also declined as a percentage of GDP, from about 30% to about 20%. Exports is up, and imports is up. And the population at the moment is 2.3 million persons. We've done a bit of analysis here of the rise in imports from Botswana, and honorable members may take note that Botswana is actually importing diamonds as well as exporting diamonds. So when De Beers made Botswana their global headquarters for their diamond business, Botswana became the place where De Beers concentrates its diamonds from South Africa, Namibia, Canada, centralizes it there, and then processes it, and then re-exports it. Some of the big re-export places would be places like Belgium and India, the next slide, slide 7, shows where Botswana imports goods. Honorable members will see principally from South Africa, except in the case of medicines. We run a trade surplus with Botswana, and the medicine story on slide 8 is very interesting. If honorable members look at the data, there's a spike in 2016, and we've looked at other complementary data sources and saw that there was a significant increase in medicines that's made available to citizens of Botswana in that period. Government had a policy change, but interestingly, look at the Indian share. India has now become the most significant supplier of medicines to Botswana. Honorable members will see the caste story. South Africa is dominant there. And unlike a few other neighboring countries, we outperform Japan. Japan, of course, if I recall, is second-hand cars. And in this case, South Africa is still a dominant player in the car market and in the truck market. 95% of trucks sold in Botswana are from South Africa. The next slide is we took a different look. We said something like mobile phones and computers. Who are the main suppliers in the region? And South Africa is the main supplier, even though we're not a big producer of PCs, and we don't assemble mobile phones. And that is because the big companies who tend to centralize their purchases in Johannesburg and then re-export from there. The next slide, 11, shows our trade balance with Botswana and what we buy from Botswana: diamonds, insulated cable, carbonates, beef, and pipes and hoses. So that's the trade data. Next, we turn to changing the investment narrative. Honorable members will recall that President Ramaphosa was elected in February this year. State of the Nation address took place. And in SONA, he set out his vision. And at the start of the new financial year, we put a significant effort into changing the country's investment narrative. After a period when that narrative was somewhat unclear, we focused a lot more. Here's a few examples. A roundtable at the Gibbs Business School with business leaders, engagement with corporate CEOs, local ones like ShopRite, Checkers, global ones, engagements with presidential investment envoys and providing support for their efforts. Working with foreign investors, for example, the Joburg meeting of the World Economic Forum in June, a speech to an Italian South African businesses, and addressing visiting investors from China. Those are the kind of examples of what we did in that period. We engaged with the financial sector. There's some details set up there. and with businesses at sector or workplace level, and we'll come back to some of that in due course. The next area that I wanted to briefly comment on is the focus on scrap metal. It's a piece of work that was done in quarter one as well as quarter two. A lot of our work, they can't easily be confined just to a sector. It's not like building a house, which is done. The work continues over more than one sector. But for ease of reporting, we're reporting it in quarter one. We have a price preference system in place, introduced in 2013. It expires in 2018 under the original terms, and honorable members will recall the terms of it. It's set out there. It's really to require exporters to first offer the scrap metal at a price discount to local players. During quarter one, we commenced a review of the impact of the price preference system on the industry, and it included whether we should have a long-term extension of the PPS with amendments to the terms, or whether we should replace it with an export tax. And because we had not yet completed that review, we took the decision at the time that we should extend the PPS for a nine-month period, put out a public call, and honorable members will see the Government Gazette there. And we received a number of comments, the vast majority which supported the renewal of the policy directive. Agni Steel, which is a Eastern Cape steelmaker, said in the existence of Agni Steels and its 288 employees was solely due to the implementation of the PPS. Cisco Steel, which is a foreign investment here in the Western Cape, says after the startup of Cisco, the PPS system started to work for Cisco and a lot of export permits were stopped, of which most of the scrap was made available to us. Cape Gate said they support the renewal as domestic consumers need to have mechanisms to secure ferrous and non-ferrous material for consumption. CIFSA, the country's largest sector business association, said the PPS is fundamental to the success of Hulamin, and they then give some details. Hulamin itself says it remains of the view that the PPS played a pivotal role in giving local consumers the ability and negotiating leverage to secure the scrap purchases. And some submissions says, look, we're in agreement with the extension for 9 months, but there are gaps and problems. And please fix these when you look at the thing. But generally, wide support for the measure. The next slide shows the impact. You'll see there, if you look at ferrous scrap as an example, in 2013, we had 1.6 million tons, and if you look at 2017, it had been reduced to only 471,000 tons. Copper scrap also quite a significant drop. A small rise in aluminium scrap from 2013 to 2017, but on the whole, a reduction in the declared tonnage and value of scrap metal. Following this consideration, I extended the PPS for a nine-month period from the 21st of September. The next area is the opening of the Cisco plant. We opened this plant on the 30th of May. It's a Turkish investment. It started production already in September last year, and they were supported with an IDC loan, and they're the second largest Turkish investment in South Africa. And by way of just recalling its background, it's a very old factory itself, 50 years old, that closed 8 years ago with 360 jobs lost. And they're now producing 8,800 tons. It's used in the country's infrastructure program, but they're also exporting to countries as diverse as the United States, Mozambique, Uganda and others. Cisco is a worker trust with 15% of shares set aside for employees of the company. Turning next to Focus 5, it's just to update the committee on work that had been done previously by the department, and it's now come to fruition. Honourable members may recall we had previously said we are attempting to work with a company called Impact. It's a packaging company, and we helped them, among others, to get a water use license. That company is now launched publicly, and they employing just over 500 people in the building phase. So they've now cleared the land and they're ready to build that factory. When the factory is completed, they will have between 45 and 50 permanent employees. So there you have a really useful intervention that we've taken step by step and supported. The next one is the Competition Amendment Bill. The committee would be very familiar with the detail of the bill. But during this quarter, we did work on reviews of public submissions. We engaged with legal advisors. We had discussions within government and with the competition authorities. A significant part of our engagement was with the business community and with organized labor. And these included bilateral meetings as well as engagements at NEDLAC. The NEDLAC task team met three times during the quarter, and that enabled us to finalize a report. We also, in this period, developed different options to look at the submissions from the public, and it gave me an opportunity then, based on the different options, to identify the most appropriate ones. Some of the areas are set out on slide 21 that we engage in, things like market opening, boosting investment by ensuring that the concentrated nature of the economy is addressed, the yellow card provisions, penalty regimes, and so on. Those are matters that the committee has gone through in a lot of detail in the subsequent quarter, but this quarter we did the technical evaluation on a number of these issues. Fourth Industrial Revolution debate, I was invited by a joint parliamentary committee to make a presentation on the Fourth Industrial Revolution, and this brought together members of both the National Assembly and the NCOP to ensure that Parliament develops a thoughtful approach to the Fourth Industrial Revolution. Those 14 points highlight some of the key issues that I had raised in that engagement, from mapping and monitoring our capability in South Africa to looking at opportunities for new industry, how it will change government with e-government, impact on health and education, the spatial dimension when you now have increasingly driverless cars, what it will mean for mass transport systems, energy, ICT, all of these are affected by the Fourth Industrial Revolution. Skills is a key issue. Someone said the other day that coding should be a compulsory language in schools. In other words, computer speak, so that we don't only teach people to have indigenous languages and international languages, but we also teach them computer language. Among others, we looked at issues like investment in R&D, industrial funding for commercialization, jobs, wages, social policy, SMMEs in entrepreneurship, smart regulation, what the Fourth Industrial Revolution means for our Africa strategy, global partnerships, how we work with big global companies, and communication within society to ensure citizens feel included in the debate about the Fourth Industrial Revolution. Here we provide the committee with some information on IDC funding in activities that it describes as Fourth Industrial Revolution projects. And to give you, honorable members, an idea, if you see that toolkit there, that toolkit has been printed using what is called 3D printing. So it's something that looks almost like a printing machine. And what they do to make that machine there. They don't do a mold. Normally, what you do is you do a mold, and then, if I just simplify it, you pour the metal into the mold, and you open the mold, and out come your spanner or something. This is a very different technology. There they print a layer, like a printing machine, one thin layer, and then they print another layer, and another layer, till eventually you have, and what they printed with is not ink, it's basically a metal component, but extremely thin, and slowly you build up a tool, so you can make this microphone, you can make this cup, you can't yet print the tea itself, but you can print a desk to sit on, a chair to sit on. It is quite an interesting thing, and you can see how it's going to completely transform our world, 3D printing. So the IVC is backing a company called Metal Heart. It was founded in 2017 by two individuals who previously worked for a company that made fasteners and general do-it-yourself items. And so they, one day, when working at the company, they made designs to improve the performance of the factory. But a number of their designs could not be implemented because traditional tool-making machines couldn't make it. And this led them to the idea of what is called additive manufacturing, or what we call 3D printing. And additive manufacturing then led them to essentially start their own business. So I think it's a really interesting story that we need to keep on watching. Here is another interesting example. This is Professor Sabelo Mshlanga, and he owns a company called Sabi Nano Trading. And the IDC has supported this effort, and there the write-ups indicates that carbon nanotubes are cylindrical carbon molecules that have very special properties that you can use in all sorts of these things, and you can manufacture high-tech material from it. And Sabi Nano was founded in 2008 by the professor to manufacture these nanotubes based on a production method known as the catalytic chemical vapor deposition. And this technology was developed by way of a doctoral studies program that the two professors were involved in. And later they started to commercialize this. Now, why I've gone into a little bit of detail here is a lot of interesting research takes place at university, and people come up with fantastic ideas. The big gap is creating jobs with that. And so here's an example where the IDC has now said, look, you've got a good idea. Let's work together to see how we can create an industry stream of products out of it. And it's early days, but they've now set up a manufacturing facility, and they're hoping to improve and expand. The next one is a company called Takadu Metals, and this was founded by Ruli Diseko, a young black industrialist. He saw opportunities in the growth of raw materials used for the manufacture of batteries. Batteries is becoming almost like the new oil for the century. If you think about so much, this point I'm using uses batteries, my mobile phone, the laptop, everything. And the big problem with batteries is they don't last very long. And so a lot of the economic opportunity for the future is to make long-lasting batteries. Batteries that can replace the engines of cars, batteries that can be used in small appliance applications and so on. And here essentially is an example of using a crude nickel sulfate, which is if you're mining for platinum, this is a byproduct. It's almost like the waste that come out of the process. And they're looking at using it in battery production. Moving a bit quicker, we did a visit with President Ramaphosa to the Volvo plant in this period, and I met with the company while we were busy at the plant to try to identify opportunities to localize more products that Volvo uses in their big trucks. Following that, the department, I asked the department to follow up, and Mohamed Vardo is here today, met with a company, and they identified possible products. At the moment, we're looking at a fuel tank made of aluminium as a possibility, and now it has to go through the Volvo Global quality control, so it will take a bit of time, because you can imagine how important the safety of a fuel tank is on these big trucks. You don't want it exploding, you don't want it leaking, and so on. So once it meets all those tests, we hope it to then be suitable for use by Volvo. Also had a community meeting in Atlantis in this period on the special economic zone. There was a report prepared by the department on spatial patterns, the difference of between cities, the commercial center of cities, townships, rural areas, and the different growth rates and employment levels, and this will be used in engagement with provinces. We did a bit of work on the social economy. Dr. Molefe Pule, who heads that piece of work for us, is here today, and he is now taken over trying to drive the work on the social economy, set up a project steering committee, commissioning work, engaging with people like the British Council, IDC, UCT, and others, to try to get together ideas and thinking that will help to shape our approach to the social economy. Try to learn from what's happened elsewhere in the world also. Next is the reports on cooperatives in the Pongola area. Here the department worked with seven cooperatives that had gone basically quiet, you could say almost dead, and we helped to facilitate workshops with SARS, Small Business Development, and CEDA, and where there were problems, we helped to unblock those problems. There are some details on the slide, and 59 persons were supported with training. And we're helping 42 to at least complete their funding applications. We can't, of course, guarantee that they'll get funding from the agencies, but at least get them into the queue. And the honorable members will see the kind of products, poultry, catering, hairdressing, and so on. On the training layoff scheme, TLS stands for Training Layoff Scheme. It's something that we introduced, and EDD was at the center of introducing it in 2009 during the recession that we had almost 10 years ago. And over the years, the system became more clogged up. It's not a system that that EDD runs. After we had helped to design it, we responsibility for administration of it passed to the Department of Labor. The Department of Labor is very enthusiastic about it, but the rules that came in over the years made it difficult for companies to access this facility. And so we did a review of it. The department made some recommendations, and these all were fed into a process at NEDLAC, and it led to certain changes. The changes were, among others, that responsibility should now rest with the CCMA to run the training layoff scheme. There'll be a structure where Productivity SA, Department of Labor, EDD, and others will be in, and that there will be a single set of qualifying criteria. The maximum payments was increased. There's a reporting mechanism, and we've given the CCMA a target of responding within 20 days to any of the requests and finalizing matters. Now, that's the policy. So how has it worked in practice? Even though we haven't yet completed the work, I went to Atlantis in June and found a large number of young people who were very disgruntled, very unhappy. And they came to a community meeting where we were talking about small business development, and they said, but look, we're working at this company called GRI. It's a manufacturer of wind towers. The company is on short time. We haven't had pay for many months. We're frustrated. And it became evident that the frustration was spilling over into socially bad behavior by the workers concerned. So we asked, what about getting onto the training layoff scheme while the company sorts out its order book? And it appeared they had applied but were not getting through. So we asked one of the EDD staff members, Tanya van Mieler, she's here now, to just really focus on getting this thing over the finish line. And eventually, by the time we completed, it took a while, we got the company registered on the training layoff scheme, and 140 workers' jobs were saved as a result, because the alternative would have been retrenchment. And Atlantis as a town benefited with 5.5 million rand, call it wage injection, into the economy, because people now get this training layoff stipends or payment. So it's a little example of how often our policies are well conceived, but the design is a problem and the implementation is a bigger problem. That too many of our bureaucracies like to tell people why they don't qualify. That there isn't a commitment to saying, if people are poor and the community really has a difficulty, can the rules be communicated to people so that they can comply with it? Can we work with a company to access a facility, as opposed to simply saying, you haven't ticked all the boxes, sorry. So I think that this goes much wider, as honorable members will see in another part of the presentation we'll deal with later. We've done quite a bit of work on the PICC for Cabinet, 17 key construction update reports. We unblocked the Lion Ropeway. That's an aerial ropeway project that's co-supported with the IDC, and it goes over mining land. And the question that came up here is, because it goes over mining land, must it also comply with all of the requirements that typically applies in a mine? We helped unblock that, and the project could then continue. We did some work on the construction industry, met with some companies, facilitated a meeting with other ministers to try to unblock slow movement by some of the public entities. A number of meetings, honorable members will see in slide 43, sub-coordinators, secretariat meetings, trustees meetings, and then technical project assessment of the Clan William Dam, and an advisory meeting with senior management of DWS, and honorable members will see on slide 45 what that entailed. A number of challenges that slowed down the Clan William Dam. We did a technical site visit as PICC, and then communicated the outcome of that to the Minister of Water and Sanitation. We also did advisory meetings with senior management of the Department of Water and Sanitation, which led to a site visit by that minister based on the work, among others, that we've done, and subsequently approval of 300 million rand for the project. So it's one leg. It's not the full price, but one leg to get the project moving. On localization, we did work with the Royal Bafokeng Properties Company on an electrical heat tracing project. 4 million rand was approved by the IDC to do pre-feasibility studies, and we look forward to seeing what the outcome of this will be. And one of the key things is to see, can we manufacture fuel cells that can be used by buses by bigger transport. The big debate now on fuel cell technology is it's a different way. Instead of the traditional ways of powering vehicles, can you use fuel cells? At the moment, no one has yet found a way to do it in a commercially viable way for cars, but there is a possibility it could be used for bigger trucks and buses, which will give the platinum industry a big boost. Moving on, 6 unblockings. The first one is a Singapore company that uses imported specialty steel, which isn't made locally. They fell victim of a safeguard duty. The High Commissioner of Singapore approached us, and we helped to unblock this, and the company is now operating successfully. SA Calcium Carbine, it's a chemical chemical plant in Newcastle, with an IDC loan. They went into business rescue, and the IDC wanted terms that would have led the factory just to close. We worked with the IDC and the company to see, can we find a way to protect the IDC's interest, but at the same time give the company the space to trade back into profitability. That worked. The foreign shareholders subsequently, when they saw that we really prepared to stretch a little bit, they put extra money, 15 million rand, into the business, and we hope that this will prove to be a success story with time. A project on B. Braun, a company that is going to use a vacant IDC factory. They do medical technology and pharmaceutical products, and they had to make a decision. Where do they set up the factory? They said, look, we're like South Africa. They applied for the normal benefits. They were told by the affected agency that the benefits had run out, and they decided, okay, we'll now move to either Argentina or Russia. We then intervened and worked with the agency to give them the necessary commitments, and they now have decided that they will, in fact, set up their operation in South Africa, and some of what they're going to produce that will in fact even export out of the country to the rest of Africa and to the European Union. Brika South Africa, it's a producer of concrete slabs in Newcastle. They asked for our assistance to get supplies for their operation. We took them to visit the ArcelorMittal site, and they took samples of the slag that was available at AMSA, and they found if they use that to make the concrete slabs, they actually do a better concrete slab, because the slag itself has no clay content, so they can reduce waste quite a lot. So it's just a better raw material, and as a result of this intervention by EDD, they've now decided to take on an extra 13 workers, and it's again a good story there that we can only support. Dagama Textiles, they applied for a production incentive from government because they wanted to get a water treatment plant installed. But because they needed to get municipal permission for this plant, they stalled the application. And when they put the application eventually in, they were told, sorry, the due date has passed. And this is a very significant factory. People who from the Eastern Cape will tell honorable members that it's an iconic Eastern Cape factory. And it was going to close. We got involved and helped to troubleshoot the matter. The company got the water use license, and they got the production incentive that was applicable. Sheraton Textiles, this is a company that's wholly owned by the IDC. It had not gotten a BEE facilitator status, so technically it was regarded as zero BEE, even though it was owned by government through the IDC. So every time Sheraton wants to sell sheets to places like At Home, Edcon, Sun International, and so on, they will be asked, are you a BEE company? And they would have to say, no, we're not a BEE company. Then if you're an importer and you're going to buy your sheets from China, but you're a black shareholder, you would be a BEE player. So Edcon, Sun International, Protea, and so on would get more BEE points for importing their linen than from buying it from a local factory. So honorable members can see that this thing obviously isn't intended to work like that. So we fixed the problem. The Sheraton was given its BEE facilitator status, which the regulations permit, and it will now get 94 million rand in orders that it would have lost, it tells us, and so we've kept some jobs going here in the Western Cape as a result of that. We also have information on slide 56 on the IDC, on 57 on the quarterly approvals of the IDC, 58 the sector approvals, the 59 the engagements with the IDC on a strategic level, 61 we report on mergers involving Pioneer Foods and Heinz, as well as Robertson's, where Unilever sold their Rondo Stork Rama and Flora business to Robertson's. In both cases, employment conditions were put on the mergers, and in the case of Robertson's, they could not retrench any worker as a result of the merger. We also report on import penetration. This is still work we need to refine somewhat. I'd love to have it at sector level, but there are technical problems, so we've just got this as totals, meaning for the economy as a whole. If honorable members look at 1994, the blue line will show the import share of total expenditure in the country. And you read the percentage on this side here, on the right-hand side. And honorable members will see how it's gone up over the years. It's even higher because of illegal imports. So this is understated. We did a little modeling. If only 10% of imports were replaced by local production across the economy, that would be 500,000 jobs. So it's really how to then find ways to get more local purchases. That means improving quality, efficiency, price issues, but also ensuring that we police our borders properly with the regulations and the tariffs that are applicable. 64 talks about our engagements with economic regulatory bodies. That's what ERBs stand for. Slide 66 is on human resource management. It gives some information on our spending by personnel program on slide 67 and 68. 69 deals with gender equity, 70 deals with people with disabilities, and then we deal with the financial reporting on slide 72. We spend 225 million rand out of the allocated 1.1 billion rand. Now when I say we spend, it's not the department itself that spend. It's come through the department, but that would include all the transfers to the agencies. If one looks at what the department itself spent, it spent 31 million rand, 30.9 million rand, and the rest were transfers of 194 million rand to entities. The department achieved a total spending of 98% of its target. Slide 73 breaks that down in a bit of detail by program, the amount on budget, the actual, the variance, and how much, what percentage was spent. There's expenditure per economic classification, how much was on staff, and honorable members will see that the goods and services and staff are obviously the two significant ones. The percentage there in that table is not a percentage of all of the spending. It's a percentage against budget. The next slide, 75, deals with the analysis of spending by program, looking at the information for quarter one. What was our projected spend? What's our actual spend? We overspent slightly on compensation of employees. We underspent slightly on goods and services. And we underspent quite significantly on payment for capital assets. Capital assets are not things that you buy equally through the year. So one would normally expect big variations between quarters. Staff you spend right through the year. It should be, broadly speaking, the same kind of amount. But capital, you only buy cell phones or printers or computers or cars on what they call a lumpy basis. That's not a smooth basis. And then we have analysis of spending for Program 2 and Program 3. For the entities, we set out the details. And then finally, reasons for variation. So that's the quarter one report. And if we can just have a moment, we'll go to quarter two. So this, in the old days, Honorable Chair, Acting Chair, was the intermission. And when I grew up, this is when the Laurel and Hardy cartoons would come on, and Charlie Chaplin and so on. So the bioscope is back. This is quarter two, and it covers the period, Chair, from the 1st of July to the 30th of September. And the report here we are. Honorable Atkinson has missed the references to the fourth industrial revolution that we had in the previous presentation, and it points to where the future is, where all committee members would have all of this on their screens and would be able to manage it all without having to watch it on here. But thank you very much for bearing with us. So what we will be seeking to do here, honorable members, is covering the economic and employment overview, but we're going to do it in a bit more detail than normally for this quarter, partly because this work up to the end of September led into the stimulus and recovery package that the President announced and all the other activities culminating in the investment conference. So if I may start with that, here we're going to, over the next number of slides, really focus on the economy and then we'll come back to the department's normal work. We start in slide 4 by looking at the economic context. The GDP figures were available up to the end of June. We have not yet received the data up to the end of September, so we're using the latest available information. And what honorable members can see here is that the GDP, if I use this side, so the chair can also see, there's been a contraction in the GDP for 2 quarters. So what that means is, technically you're in a recession. And we've taken the period up from 2014. Honorable members will then see that typically you have 1 quarter of decline and a couple of quarters of growth, but if you have 2 quarters of decline, it would be regarded as recession. GDP for the previous quarter was also revised down. Every so now and then, Statista gets better information. They come back and they say, look, we underestimated or we overestimated. So about a year ago, they had declared that we were in a recession. Subsequently, they revised the information and said, no, no, it wasn't a recession. Here they've revised the information and said quarter four was actually worse than they had originally thought. And so this gives honorable members a good sense of the storyline. Now, what's happened here? The main contraction was in agriculture in this period. And that was not because agriculture is in terminal decline. Agriculture actually did very well previously. And so this was a sharp contraction from where agriculture had grown to. The next one looks at the information in a little bit more detail. We've given the quarter four and the quarter one data. It indicates contractions were in agriculture, transport 5%, trade 2%, government 0.5%, manufacturing 0.3%. Mining saw the biggest growth. So mining actually grew in this period. It grew by 4.9%, followed by construction 2.3%, and business services 1.9%. Turning to slide 6, now how the GDP is calculated. You can calculate it either on your expenditure side, or you can look at your different sectors. If you look at the expenditure side, what you and I spend in shops, which is called household consumption, that decreased by 1.3% after 8 quarters of increase. Investment also decreased, and firms spend about 5 billion rand less on building up their stocks, what is called inventory. Slide 7 gives a result for the year. So up to now, I've given results for the quarter. If you compare the quarter with the previous quarter and you annualize the figures, what is the story? But if you actually compare it year on year, real GDP increased by 0.4%. It's very, very low. Means it's positive, but not keeping up with what we need to be able to do to address our challenges. The top three growth sectors are highlighted there, and the ones that year on year were in decline are indicated in red. Slide 8 is a very interesting one. What we did here, we looked at periods when the economy went through a recession. So the gray are periods of a recession, and the white is a period without recession, and we took it from 1968 to 2018, so it's a 50-year period. And what it shows, if honorable members will see, that if from 1968 to about 74, 75, we had 78 months without recession. Then we had a recession. Then there was a short period without recession. Then there was another recession. Then there was a slightly longer period without recession. There was quite a significant recession. You can see how thick that line is. Then there was 54 months without recession, then another recession, a tiny break without recession, and then a long recession. So we had quite a deep recession year, if you add all of that together. Then we had 189 months without recession. That's from just before the democratic transition, right up to the global economic crisis. Then we had a recession in 2009, and then we had 102 months without recession, and we've now hit a recession again. So it helps to give us a sense of perspective on the issue, but it underlies still that when you're in a recession, even if it's a shallow recession, you're basically losing wealth at the time when you should be increasing the stock of wealth so that there's more that government can tax and spend on social services, there's more that people can earn by way of wages and profits and dividends and so on, that they can use to spend, they can use to invest. So recessions are always bad things for the economy. But it does show us that we've had two long periods without recession, and they both were in the democratic era. And in the previous era, we had shorter periods without recession. Now, that was on the GDP. If we turn next to employment. Now, employment, we've got better information in the sense that the information comes up to the end of September, whereas the GDP data doesn't come up to the end of September. So what we've done is we first just took quarter one, which is up to June. And then we'll spend a bit more time on quarter two. So quarter one, the economic data or the employment data shows the labor force increased by 12,000. 90,000 jobs were lost. The unemployed increase and the unemployment rate increase. And I'll come back to that. The main job-creating provinces for the quarter were Mpumalanga, Eastern Cape, and KwaZulu-Natal. The ones that shed jobs were Northern Cape, Limpopo, Gauteng, North West, Free State, and Western Cape. So I'm going to draw attention to, let's take Gauteng with 14,000 job losses and Western Cape with 50,000 job losses. And then I'm going to just compare how that then looks in the next quarter. So honorable members will see these numbers fluctuate. So you've got to look at the annual trend rather than the trend only in one quarter. So let's then turn to quarter two. Quarter two is very, very interesting. Because what quarter two shows is 92,000 jobs were created in the sector. Now, if you think about it, 92,000 jobs in 3 months is a very significant level of job creation. But at the same time, the number of unemployed increased by 127,000. How can that be? How could you create a very significant number of new jobs and have a significant rise in unemployment? The reason is 131,000 people who previously were so discouraged, they didn't even want to look for work. And if you don't look for work, you're not described as unemployed. They now said, we're going to look for work. So they re-entered the labor market. They were outside the labor market completely. They re-entered the labor market. So even though the economy created 92,000 jobs, you had not only your ordinary number of people coming into the labor market, in other words, young people who are now of working age, but you also had people who previously stayed at home, not looking for a work, suddenly looking for jobs in this period. Now, if honorable members look at the labor force, it increased by 219,000. Go back two slides to quarter one. The labor force only increased by 12,000. Go forward two slides, you'll see now it increased by 219,000. Which is why the quarterly unemployment figures, whilst we should not ignore them, can only be properly understood if we look at annual blocks. If we try to see the bigger pattern rather than the variations quarter by quarter. So in this period, the unemployment rate for the quarter increased from 27.2% to 27.5%, and the unemployment number increased by 127,000. Now, if we take the year as a whole, 188,000 jobs were created over the 12 months. The number of unemployed decreased by 1,000. The unemployment rate decreased from 27.7% to 27.5%, still extraordinarily high, and so we're not making a serious dent in the levels of unemployment over this period. Then we break up the new jobs by sector. Where were the jobs created? The single biggest number of new jobs were in business services. These are private sector business services, things like finance, security services, anything that's not trade and buying and selling related that is a service in the private sector would be clustered under business services. Trade, that's buying and selling, 86,000. Construction, 27,000. Then wherever you see the brackets, it means we've lost jobs. So in agriculture, we lost 1,000 jobs in that quarter. And if honorable members look at government, we lost 17,000 jobs in that quarter. Okay. If we look at it for the 12 months as a whole, the biggest growth in the 12 months was in construction jobs. 137,000 extra jobs, followed by government. So here you see for the quarter there was a dip in government, but for the year as a whole there's a growth in government and business services. Again, agriculture, for the quarter it had a loss of jobs. For the year as a whole it had 32,000 new jobs. But on the other hand, if you take the 12 months as a whole, manufacturing had a fairly sharp decline. 30,000 jobs were lost. Mining had a sharp decline. 40,000 jobs were lost. And private households, 46,000 jobs were lost. The next slide does the jobs per province. So I had asked honorable members to take note in the previous quarter about Gauteng and Western Cape. Gauteng had lost jobs, Western Cape had lost jobs. In this quarter again, Gauteng has gained jobs, 22,000 jobs. Western Cape gained jobs, 14,000 jobs. So you see between two quarters these vast variations. And in this case, Eastern Cape and Free State again are losing jobs. For the year, these are the figures for the year as a whole. The single biggest job-creating province for the quarter was Limpopo. For the year was KwaZulu-Natal. Labor market trends since the NGP, 2.7 million more jobs were created and 1.5 million more unemployed. And this illustrates it very, very well again. If honorable members look at this slide, the population only grew by 1.8%. Jobs grew by 2.3%, so jobs were growing faster than employment. But because discouraged work seekers and young people are entering the labor market, the labor force grew faster than population. So South Africa's labor market statistics is more complex than what is often reported when people quickly catch a headline, one way or the other. And interestingly, we see a similar pattern in some of the other Southern African countries. Jobs by industry since the adoption of the new growth path. The single biggest growth in one sector was government, 870,000. But if you take all the private sector jobs together, then the very big driver of new jobs would be the private sector. It would be business services, construction, trade, agriculture, mining, private households. In this period, there's only one sector. This is a period from 2010 to 2018. There's only one sector that had a net job loss, and it's manufacturing. And incidentally, it's something that you see generally with manufacturing in most economies, that jobs decline because productivity rise. And so this doesn't mean that the sector's output is declining, but it does mean its share of total employment declines, and in this case, the total number of people employed is also declining. One of the interesting things that we're trying to do a little bit more work on is to understand what has been the impact of labor broking on these numbers. Because labor brokers would be classified under business services. So it seems to us from our Stats essays using the data, what we need to investigate further is, are some of the business service jobs, jobs that properly should be classified in any of these? So that's a piece of work that we would need to do in future. We've got some initial indication of how much of it is business, is labor broking, but not the breakdown into which sectors of the economy that is. Okay, so honorable members, if I can then move to the slowing economic growth. We saw already in June that the economy was slowing down. So before we even got to a recession, we began our piece of work on the 11th, on the 4th of June, the GDP results showed that we had one quarter of decline. A week later, we convened a meeting with the IDC executive to see what we could do to support vulnerable industries. On the 27th of June, we called a meeting of the Economic Development Council, which is all the agencies that EDD is responsible for. We invited the DTI to that. And we said, what can we do to create a piece of work on a job-centered stimulus package? On the 31st of July, the President announced that government would be formulating a stimulus package to ignite growth. In August, we had meetings in the economic cluster. Then we had the Cabinet Lekgotla, and we worked with National Treasury. On the 4th of September, the new GDP data was released, which revealed the economy had, in fact, contracted and entered the recession, and on the 21st of September, the President announced the economic stimulus package. What I want to do in the next few number of slides is take a focus area to see what work we did to try to get the economy back to growing. The first is to change the investment climate and the narrative and the confidence of investors. We did some work in the previous quarter that I reported. In July, honorable members will see there what we did. Fashion industry, competition amendments, Chinese state visit, BRICS summit. In August, the meeting with the UK Prime Minister, delegation from Singapore, including the Deputy Prime Minister, Indian businesses. In September, the consultancy forum with South African business, addressed to CEOs of Standard Bank, engagement with ambassadors, roundtable on inclusive growth, and so on. So that was the first thing we did. We said, okay, let's talk to investors. The second thing is we had the BRICS summit. Substantial work took place in quarter two on the summit, even though the summit itself was held in quarter three. And we had a number of discussions with the BRICS partners. We also hosted a China state visit the day before the BRICS summit, and we had a number of African countries participating in a special session. We did various things. For example, the Bike, the company in the Eastern Cape that's making cars, they rolled the first bike car off the production line in July, and we signed a new visa agreement to facilitate multi-entry for certain business visitors. And out of the BRICS summit came a pledge to support African development and industrialization, a BRICS vaccine center that we hope would be in South Africa, and a BRICS tourism track to support tourism. It's also the establishment of a BRICS Women's Forum. And honorable members will see there's not a single woman in that picture. The next focus was jobs in the fashion industry. It's an industry that's been going through difficult times with a slowdown of spending and the rise of imports. So in this period, we visited the Selrose factory, launched the Mandela T-shirt in Durban, and engaged with H&M on local production. This is a picture of the Selrose factory, and this is what they have there on the side on the dummy, are shirts that young people wear. Now what they do with those shirts, they break those shirts up, and they spray paint those shirts. And people pay more money for broken, dirty-looking shirts because they're not as old as they're young. They want something looking different. So Selrose is in that kind of market. And we met with the workers and with the management of Selrose. And it's a useful example of what is happening with our competition conditions. Edcon has given Selrose more work, and they now employ 569 young people. They took on a further 125 young people in KwaZulu-Natal in the 12 months as a result of increased localization. And here, honorable members, will see a picture of Getiwe Mhlaba, 27 years old, and Bharati Naidu, 33 years old. Both of them unemployed previously and now employed as a result of this. This is the launch of the Mandela T-shirt on the 6th of July. It's the T-shirt produced to mark the 100th anniversary of Madiba's birth, but it also helped to boost a focus on fashion in the Durban area. Here is another example of the launch of the T-shirt. Here is a certain deputy minister on Nelson Mandela Day at a local high school painting and celebrating Madiba's legacy. So what we've done there is to say, what can we do to try to boost confidence in the fashion manufacturing sector? The next one is the sugar industry. The South African Sugar Association asked ITAC for an increase in duties. On the 28th of May, we hosted a meeting with stakeholders in the sugar value chain. We brought farmers together and Coca-Cola, Tiger Brands, the people who use the sugar, ShopRite Checkers, got them all in a room. And we said to them, can we find a solution that helps the farmers, but they don't damage the manufacturers too much? That we must find a balance because we were seeing large-scale notices that people were going to be retrenched on farms. And ITAC then considered the application, and on the 3rd of August, we increased the dollar-based reference price of sugar. One of the agreements that was reached between the small farmers, SAFDA, and the big farmers, SASA, was that SASA would support the small farmers if, in fact, government was able to address the problems that the farmers had. And there you have the terms of the agreement. The ITAC increases took place here on the board. And honorable members will see that there's been a decline in imports. These are imports. So you see the massive spike in imports in this period. And we hope that the import levels would remain relatively modest. And here's a photo of the meeting with the sugar players. In the last two quarters, we also hosted small business imbizos to support SME development. Did one in Otri, in Khayelitsha, and in Sutherland in the Northern Cape. And Deputy Minister, in fact, had a significant number that will be reported when we come back with the provincial reports in quarter four, where we're going to put that together. But this is just a few pictures from the Otri small business in Bizo. Khayelitsha we had, we brought in CIPC, SARS, and the finance agencies, and we sat them down with the local business community. And it was very, very interesting because we found that communities don't know how to access the services. And normally what the agencies would do is to say, go to our website. So we actually asked these small businesses in Khayelitsha, who of you have actually been on a website, on a business website? Just put up your hands. Who has not been? And the overwhelming number of people had never been. So we're creating systems, because they're 21st century, that just isn't accessible to many small entrepreneurs who are just trying to make a living in a local area. As a result of the Khayelitsha intervention, I am advised that 10 businesses were registered, 7 businesses were given tax clearance certificates, and 1 funding application is being considered. And that's just pictures of the Khayelitsha small business in Bizo. We did a study also, a trip to Sutherland in the Northern Cape. It was a follow-up to a previous visit to Sutherland 2 years ago. And 45 small business entrepreneurs attended. And we had a lot of public agencies also there. As a result of this, 12 new companies were registered. CEDA did a preliminary assessment of 9 business plans. SARS issued 5 tax clearance certificates and helped 1 company with their tax returns. And the provincial treasury put a few companies on their central supplier database, and CIFA took 8 funding inquiries. And that's a picture of some of the business. Now, this is a tiny little town, and it's a town where there's very little facilities. And one of the things that was striking here is that from a, if you take CIPC, they don't have an office there. So the local, the Pretoria representative came down to look now, how do people in small towns actually register? So if you can do it online, it's easy, but many people don't know how to do it online. So they're just trapped outside of the formal economy. So we helped them, people registered. Then the question was, now they must pay. They must pay, I think it's about 150 rand or so. So where do they pay? They must pay through APSA. There is no APSA bank in the town, but there's an ATM. Well, they can pay through the ATM. But then we discovered that ATM doesn't have a deposit facility. You can draw money, but you can't deposit money. So they had to make a special arrangement with Standard Bank. Now, this is just one little town, but that kind of problem, I raised it earlier with one of the other issues, is how to get public agencies to customize themselves to serve the people. I think sometimes my sense is, as I'm going through these various Imbizo, is that agencies expect the people to customize themselves to the agencies. That they want the people to adjust to the delivery platforms that agencies have. And it's not practical. It's not going to work. So we need a mindset change in public entities to be much more service-oriented. Tourism, we did a piece of work with Minister Hanekom and the IDC. And it looked at mega projects to be considered, for example, a major upscale of Maropeng, the cradle of humankind in Gauteng. Here you have the Sterkfontein Caves, you've got this significant museum, you've got surrounding area where there are deer and zebra and so on it, and we're not utilizing it. It's 30, 45 minutes drive from the cities, and it could be such a big attraction to South Africa. And it's poorly marketed, it's relatively modestly developed. And so we're looking, can you scale this up so that the millions and millions of people who travel globally will want to put on their bucket list that they must at least come to the origins of humanity in South Africa Why South Africa? Because it's very near to Joburg. You could land, and 30 minutes later, you can be at this. And now we need to make it more capable of taking large numbers. There's the hole in the wall, Port St. John's, and other key projects in the Eastern Cape, Vilakazi Street Precinct in Soweto, Astro Tourism in Sutherland and Carnarvon, and so on. And the other part of tourism, besides developing these iconic things, is how to make it more accessible to ordinary people. Yes, we can build hotels, and they play a big role, but if we can really get the B&B stays well developed, including township stays, you can get many more people making money out of tourists coming to South Africa. And so you build a much bigger national base of support for tourism. And we're looking now with Minister Anukum, what can we do to improve that? The next slide sets out some of the technical work. Competition Amendment Bill, we did a little bit of work in this quarter with the Portfolio Committee. Slide 41 is the sale of Chevron. Now, honorable members will recall we had previously said that Chevron, the Caltex brand, was going to be sold to the Chinese, Sinopec. So they agreed on the terms, and then one of the local shareholders made the company an offer. They had what you call a right of first refusal. It means that before the sale goes through, they can make a counter offer. So they exercised that, they made a counter offer, they equaled the Chinese, and they won the right to buy the Caltex garages. They were supported by a Swiss company called Glencore, and we required that the new company must give us the same terms that the Chinese had given. So the terms that were agreed was $6 billion of new investment, preserving South African jobs after the merger, a 220 million rand fund for small business development, South Africans to own and control most of the petrol service station, and they also increased the BEE shareholding to above 90%, but though that looks good, there is a clause that Glencore can buy those shares, so it's not going to be as spectacular, the BEE part. But the rest of it, they've locked into it, and we're now sitting with a third transaction, so I'm going to come back to the committee next year with another transaction also involving Chevron. It's the first time in competition history that I know of that you've had three consecutive bids all within roughly the same space for control of the same company. AB InBev, honorable members knows, would recall the agreements that we had previously reached with AB InBev. We've asked for a report. The preliminary report indicates the company has contracted 351 emerging farmers into its supply chain, and there you have the other things that the company is doing. We will now begin to work both with the company and monitor this program to make sure that these are substantial commitments, because this is really where we need to go on the farming side, is to bring small-scale farmers into commercial operations so that they can be viable and they can enter into long-term agreements with off-takers like AB InBev. Economic stimulus, so that's the 10th focus. Slide 44 sets out some of the key elements of the stimulus and recovery package announced by the President. The bottom part is the work EDD is doing. It's with the IDC on illegal imports, on trade surges, on shovel-ready infrastructure projects, and on the investment conference. Where are we now broadly with the economy? We don't yet have the new GDP data. That will only come out in a few weeks' time. But the manufacturing data is out for quarter two, and that shows an encouraging increase of 1.7%. The agriculture output, the export data is out, and it shows a export increase of 12% on the previous quarter. The agriculture output is not yet out for all the sectors, but one of the things that we have been able to see is record production of citrus and of soybeans. And investment commitments, we'll come back to that in a moment. We've been in touch with all the provinces to see what they're doing to support the stimulus package. Most of them, I think, are trying to do some small alignments, but we're not yet seeing a consistent push to unlock value at provincial level, reprioritize budgets, focus on growth-inducing measures, and KZN said they're aligning their activities with the national stimulus, and they gave us a few examples. Western Cape said the next budget will outline their measures. Northern Cape has some things, and honorable members will see for the provinces. So a bit of time that's required to get them really to dig into those provincial budgets and ensure that they focus more of that on growth and on jobs. The job summit itself took place in quarter three, but the work was done in quarter two. EDD was part of a core team in together with the Department of Labor. They drove the job summit. The DG convened one of the working group government caucuses. The department did a concept document and analyzed inequality in labor market mismatches. And some of those proposals made it to the final outcome of the job summit. Slide 49 gives a bit of information on the weekly government meetings, the agreements reached, and honorable members will see the agreements on workplace mechanisms to improve partnership, reporting by business on executive pay ratios in the annual reports, those kind of areas. And then the summit itself was held on 4 to 5 October. Slide 50 gives a key set of outcomes. Together with an estimate by the Department of Labor and the social partners, that if all the agreements are implemented, it could lead to 275,000 jobs being created as a result of the commitments. Infrastructure funding. During the investment conference, the BRICS New Development Bank announced a $2 billion commitment to infrastructure spending in South Africa. And we just traced there the work we've done. In April, I had addressed a special meeting of the Banking Association and these insurance companies to discuss investment for infrastructure. In April, I hosted a meeting with a visiting delegation from Shanghai, where the BRICS New Development Bank is headquartered, and we talked to them about putting together a big package of infrastructure support. In July, the president of the New Development Bank came to South Africa, and Minister Gordon and I met with them to discuss how we can boost their commitment to South Africa. They subsequently met with President Ramaphosa, and out of that, the commitment to 2 billion rand was floated. In October, I met with the two NDB vice presidents, and an announcement was made at the investment conference for a $2 billion commitment that they're making. We must now just make sure we can put together the projects that can utilize this money. The investment conference, Focus 13, we did a substantial piece of work on the conference in the quarter, although the conference itself took place in quarter three. Just to recall, during SONA, the president announced the investment conference would be hosted. In April, we provided the president with support when he announced the target of $100 billion in new investment. In May, we met with the investment envoys to try to give them practical support. They didn't have an institutional base that they could operate from. In June, the president constituted constituted an interministerial committee, which I was asked to chair, and we then held several meetings of that committee. And in August, we met with four investment banks, RMB, Standard Bank, Goldman Sachs, and Rothschild, and we asked them to help us with support for the conference and for investment, and we said we want you to do it free of charge. So it's trying to just build a partnership that is not purely a commercial thing. More than 1,500 delegates attended the conference. They included the largest companies on the Johannesburg Stock Exchange, the biggest black industrialists, the main asset and fund managers, the youth entrepreneurs, women-owned firms, rural enterprises, delegates from the rest of the continent, foreign investors from 35 countries, including 27 of the Fortune 500 companies, parliamentarians, economic regulators, government officials, mayors, premiers, and members of cabinet. We had a pre-conference dialogue with global CEOs. We had a presidential opening plenary, 9 working sessions, 2 plenary sessions, a panel discussion that was hosted by Bloomberg and relayed on terminals right across the world. Wherever you have Bloomberg terminals, it was a live crossing. Investment pledge announcement, a working dinner with Jack Ma of Alibaba, and opening Soweto to the investment community. The working sessions covered manufacturing, mining, agro-processing, water, energy, transport, tourism, and the creative industries, venture capital, and innovation and ICT. There you see sessions of manufacturing. The gentleman right here is Gary Bell. He is the owner of Bell Equipment, which is the big yellow earth-moving equipment that you see on our roads. It's a South African company. Next to him is Graham Choice. He's a big clothing manufacturer. He does work for Fushini. Next to him would be one of the Amka people. They are into cosmetics. It's a black-owned firm selling cosmetics under the Amka name. Next to him is someone from South Africa's largest pharmaceutical company, Aspen. Next to him is the guy, Pat Nodada, who makes the buses for the My City program. So that kind of layer of people that came to, this is just one panel. You see a panel on water and infrastructure. That's the one of the vice presidents of the New Development Bank, the BRICS New Development Bank. Sitting next to him is, the lady there is an employee of the PICC. She does the work for the PICC, Anita Lutz, and of course the two ministers of cabinet. In innovation in ICT, similar. In energy, oil and gas, similar. You'll see the kind of people that were attracted to these various sessions. We did a booklet. We're making copies available to members of the committee in the hope that each of the MPs would also be investment ambassadors for South Africa. And so in this little portfolio that has been shared with the committee, you'll find a book called The Case for Investing in South Africa, which we hope as honorable members meet with investors, you're able to share some of the perspectives with the investors. There you have 10 reasons to invest in South Africa. So honorable members, with any extra money, would be encouraged to invest that money in South Africa, and there's 10 reasons to do so. The investment pledges, more than 290 billion rand, most of them were local. Big focus on trying to get local investors to commit to South Africa, because once you have stable local investment, foreign investment flows. So one-third foreign, two-thirds local. Most of it is private sector investment. Some of it is multilateral, meaning it's like the BRICS New Development Bank. and some of it is state-owned enterprises, but it's tiny, 4%. So the big one is really the private sector. Here you see a few people, this gentleman here, Mara Corporation is wanting to manufacture Africa's first cell phone. It would be the first, if it comes off the ground, or when it comes off the ground, it would be the first time on the continent that we make cell phones. Yeah, this lady is the CEO of Mondi Group, and they've announced now a big expansion plan inside the Mondi Group to expand their operations. This lady, Vedanta Resources, she represents an Indian mining company that is going to not only sink new shafts in South Africa, but is also working on beneficiation of South African ore here in the country. And Bushveld Minerals similarly are involved in a very interesting project to expand mining and beneficiation in South Africa. Then there is Jack Ma. He is the founder of a company called Alibaba. Alibaba is very well known all over the world, and it's basically a shop, a single shop, maybe the world's largest shop, if one wants to think of it that way. Amazon and Alibaba are the world's largest shops. But it's not a shop that you walk in, it's a shop you go with your finger through your computer or your cell phone. So, Honorable Acting Chair, if you wanted to buy a tie for the meeting, you could just simply go into Alibaba, click on ties. You'll probably get 100,000 different ties. You click on one of them, it debits your credit card, and it automatically sends someone off. Maybe by this afternoon they could have a tie here for you. If you want to buy any number of things, so it's the future of shopping, and he's built a massive company, and he came to South Africa at the invitation of the president to be at the investment conference. So the world out there is changing dramatically, and these are the entrepreneurs that are finding opportunity in the new economy. That's the investment conference walk in Vilakazi Street. The walk was led by the president. We went to the Hector Peterson Memorial, we had brunch at Vilakazi Street. We engaged the local traders, and there were bilateral meetings that cabinet members had with various investors. Now, what we've done with those 13 or so focus areas is to say, as part of the renewal in the economy, yes, we got some bad news with the GDP data, but we've launched a number of initiatives to, in fact, get the economy moving again, and this constitutes a big part of the work that the department did in this period. We've placed data on a trade analysis with Ethiopia in the presentation. Ethiopia is a very large country. Vulnerable members look at the population. It has 105 million people. In other words, it's almost double the size of South Africa in people. It's not; it doesn't have as much wealth, but it's a big economy. And with time, big economies with lots of people will grow to be even bigger economies. Their GDP in 2010 prices is 57.8 billion rand, or dollars rather, and it's still one of the poorest countries in the continent. They've got very high GDP growth at the moment, 10.6%. And that's very good because it will help to lift many more people out of poverty. There's a narrative sometimes that sees high growth elsewhere on the continent as somehow bad for South Africa. It's like some people think of it as a soccer league, that if we're not always top of the league, then it's bad. But if you really think about it as an African, we must have significantly higher growth in the poorest parts of the continent for people there to have access to a better life, because they're starting from a much lower base with much deeper poverty. So high growth is a key means to get people out of poverty. So our job is to try to see how one can support and nurture high growth right across the continent, not just in South Africa. Slide 64 provides some information. We buy dried veg, coffee, soya beans, flour, and sesame seeds from Ethiopia. We sell trucks, insecticides, coal, plastic, and fruit juices to Ethiopia. And here, honorable members, will see on trucking, we do sell trucks, but if you look at the value, you can see that we're not anything as big as China. So we tend to dominate countries immediately in our vicinity in terms of supply of trucks. But the further you move from South Africa into the continent, the weaker our economic relationships are, and that's where we need to move more north now in building those economic relationships. I contrast that with Botswana, where we supply 95% of Botswana's trucks. Insecticide is another interesting example. Foreign direct investment from South Africa to Ethiopia, cement, bottlers, Standard Bank, and an educational company. Moving then to the KPIs, we did a bit of work on the quarterly labor force survey, breaking down the finance and business services sector. We've done a report on chickpeas, tariff support for the sugar industry, and sectoral analysis. Chickpeas, the department worked through an intervention with the University of Venda. We had a Chickpea Farmers Day last year. So this says what has happened since then. Let me go straight to the case study. We've put in two case studies. We worked with about six or so farmers. And these would tend to be small black farmers, in this case, producing maize, vegetables, and rearing livestock. Really tiny, 5 hectares farm, 5 staff members. And in this particular case, we helped to supply seeds, and we are told that it's currently growing. What are the kind of problems that this farmer would have? Limited water supply, so you've got 2 boreholes, and frequent theft of equipment from the boreholes. So it's that kind of challenge that the farmer has. So another example, in Makado, it's a farmer that produces mangoes, lychees, and pepper dews. This is a bigger farm, 126 hectares, with 15 staff. And it's a female. The main problems she faces are irrigation and what she calls farm labor quality. We haven't found out what that means. Inadequate machines and high energy cost. She says that her pilot project is no longer prone to theft, and there's a spelling error with the mangoes, and she compared it to the mangoes and lychees that she farms. She also has the potential to expand production. She's got 4 to 5 additional hectares that's suitable for crop farming. And she needs support and mentoring with crop management if she is to grow chickpeas on a commercial basis. I've raised this here, honorable members, to show that you can't have big policy as government and expect things to work. That it's in the detail, it's in providing support at this level that the gap is in the market. How to get someone's borehole sorted out. How to help someone to understand crop rotation, how to work with someone on theft on their farms. Simple things as opposed to the bigger announcements on agriculture that small businesses need. Staying on agriculture, this shows the agriculture value add in the last 8 years. You see the sharp drop as a result of the period of the drought. The next one, 78, indicates what kind of agriculture we sell. Citrus fruits is currently our largest export, followed by grapes, then your apples, pears, and quinces, then maize, followed by nuts. So we're a big nut exporter, then strawberries, then your apricots, cherries, and so on. We're not small in dates and figs. That's quite an interesting one. And some of that is along the Orange River, where we combine sunlight and water, rice and potatoes. Who do we sell to? In this period we looked at, Netherlands, the UK, Hong Kong and China, the UAE, Japan, Russia, Botswana, the United States, Saudi Arabia, and China. So this is China mainland, and this one is Hong Kong number 3. We should probably just combine it to get an aggregate Greater China number. But we also indicate what we sell to the different countries. So to Japan, we sell maize as our top one. The people of Hong Kong like our nuts. Whereas the Chinese like our oranges. So it's slightly different composition for different countries. We're the second largest exporter of citrus fruit at the moment. This is something that's not been highly publicized in the media, but the latest crop means that we now sell oranges only second to Spain. Spain is the only country at the moment exporting more citrus fruit than us. Who buys our citrus fruit? There you see the countries. Starting with Netherlands and moving down. And then the big export is Spain, followed by South Africa, followed by China and the United States. Next, we move to agricultural export growth. Where is it growing very fast? It's growing fast to the Czech Republic, to Bosnia, to Iran, to Belarus, Sierra Leone, Djibouti, Ethiopia, South Korea, Vietnam, and Argentina. What's growing fast? Something called hop, cones, melons, pigs, certain kinds of wheat, and fruits and nuts. Now this work will help to go into a piece of dialogue, social dialogue, that we have with the agriculture sector. There's an initiative that business has put together, led by Dr. Johan van Zyl of Toyota and Rolf Meyer, to foster a more constructive dialogue between sectors of the economy and government, and we can now begin to share some of this information. We've done a fascinating piece of work on the halal trade, but that was done only in quarter 3, and we're going to make that information available in the next report. We did a report on the implementation of the Youth Accord. 83 indicates some of the background, 84 some of the aggregate employment progress, what's happened to the labor force, to employment, to unemployment in quarter 2 2013 and quarter 2 2018. And honorable members will see there what the storyline is. We did a review. We identified 4 big issues that we need to address. Implementation in government is a bit fragmented. There isn't always enough data. So we do some good things, but it's not always well set out. In slide 86 provides a bit more detail. 87 is on the PICC, 88 is on, and 89 is on support we gave the city of Cape Town to unblock a water use license to help it to build a water treatment plant during the water crisis. 90 is on key meetings that were held by the PICC. 91 is approval of a due diligence study where we helped a company, Pedayau, to ensure that it was able to get its project off the ground. And it's quite an interesting bit of detail set out there. They want to build a plant that will manufacture building panels using autoclave aerated concrete. And they've indicated this is a better material to build with. And so here we set out how we've assisted them to get off the ground. We did 7 unblockings in this period through the work of the department. There's a company called Pavati Packaging and Advanced Brushware. Advanced Brushware does these mops and brooms. And we worked with them to get them into the Massmart stores on Pavati Packaging. We again engaged with Massmart, and Massmart has now put them on as a supplier to 3 Fruit Spot stores. We worked with a company called West African Group. They, the importers and distributors of polymer, foam, and certain kinds of rubbers and chemicals. And they had a product that was previously imported free of duty. But when there was a technical change to the tariff code, they fell under the new tariff, and they were given a 10% customs duty. But their product goes as an input into the making of other products here in South Africa. And this increased their cost. They applied for a removal of the duties, got stuck in the bureaucracy. We assisted them, and the duties was reduced to 0%. There's a company called Onomo Hotels. They needed a liquor license. They got stuck. They were assisted. The Gama Textiles had a problem. In spite of us helping them with the water use license application and their production incentive, they were still battling. So they subdivided their land, and they sold off a piece of their land to help bring down their debt. And they got stuck. Again, EDD helped them with the processes with the town and regional planners. And they sold a piece of the land for 22.7 million rand, which helps them to bring down the cost of debt. And hopefully now with the big land that they have available, they hope they can also with time provide housing for their employees nearby. There's an action minute on Avgri. Honorable members with long memories will remember the name Avgri. It used to be the Eastern Transvaal Co-op. It was commercialized. It was sold to a foreigner many years ago. And we had put in a condition that they must give small farmers a discount in these massive silos. We saw small farmers were not using it very much. And we then approached the board, and we got them to agree to increase the level of the discount from 40% to 50%. And we saw many more small farmers use the facility. There was a bit of work we did with a company called Fix Liquid Production. There's a gentleman, Itumeleng Sesoho, who realized that it's easier to have for your cosmetics a dual value packaging. He designed this packaging, got a patent for it. He needed a new mold to produce it, got stuck. We helped him to meet the right agencies in government, and hopefully he would be able to get this thing going. TIA has now given him a funding for the mold, and they've referred him to Bloemfontein Central University's Product Development Technology Station. Glodina, honorable members will recall, Glodina I had previously reported to the committee. It's a towel maker in KwaZulu-Natal. They closed when Cup Homeware pulled the plug on them. The IDC stepped in. There were all sorts of problems. There was court cases involving someone who wanted to take control of the company. eventually the IDC managed to get Competition Tribunal for the sale of the business, and the company restarted operation on the 1st of October this year, and the first machines were restarted on the 1st of November, and they now employ 138 workers, most of them being people who were previously retrenched, and they hope to see their employment growing to about 211 by January next year. And the MEC and the IDC reopened the factory recently. The next one is a report on work we've done with cooperative financial institutions, and the detail is set out on slide 105. And essentially the work of the department is to try to bring more players into the provision of small-scale financial services, and two cooperative banks were supported in this period. The IDC numbers are indicated there, investment in quarter two, report of oversight meetings are set out, page 109, meetings and initiatives with the economic regulators involving EDCON, agro-processing, competitiveness fund. We've done two reports on that, and we've done some work on the economic regulators. A lot of the information is tabled for the committee to look at, but I want to draw attention to page 112, where an agro-processing competitiveness fund that EDD had raised a quarter billion rand from a fine that was imposed on a company, and most of that money has been used. Here's a list of companies that benefited from it. And honorable members will see the number. Karoo Catch, Stella Winery, Broadway Suites, FG La Pasta, Coja Dairy, Mini Fruits, Honeycomb Suites, and so on. And it continues on the next page. And then we've given a few examples of what it means. You've got Coja Dairy, you've got Best Cut Meat, and Maneli Pets. We did two reports on the Chevron merger and Mapox Mine. We did three action minutes. We reviewed ITAC's tools. This is very interesting. This is where, from the information from the industry, ITAC's initiatives on paper and paperboard led to a increase in local production of 17%. 264 million rand invested, almost 400 jobs retained, the output per worker was increased, and 4,000 small-scale tree growers were supported. We did similar things for bore steel, batteries, and steel wire products. And they just indicate, these seem very administrative, but they have a big impact on society. And having come to this slide, I'm beginning to wrap up. 122 is our engagements. 123 is the appointment of ITAC part-time commissioners, where the work started in this quarter and continued to the next quarter, and the fuel industry designation. HRD, we table this information. It was circulated in the previous version of the document. So, Chair, I'm not going to go through the detail. It would have been available to honorable members. The summary of the financial details is from 131. 500 million rand has been spent, most of it through transfers. And as I say that, I see the battery has packed up, but just in time as we got to the end of the presentation. The rest is in the handout itself, and it was pre-circulated. So, Chairperson, thank you very much for indulging us to give us such a lot of time. We've probably exhausted the time by a big margin, but it was quite a busy two quarters for us, and we wanted to table that. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Minister. Let's have a 10-minute break. Oh, sorry, there's tea outside. It's time for questions, comments, and challenges. Members? Doctor?
Thank you, Minister, for the two presentations. If I could ask a couple of questions on the first quarter report, firstly. On slide 14, you raised the issue of the price preference system and mentioned the fact that other mechanisms, such as an export tax, are being considered as replacements for the PBS. I wanted to know, has any work been done on how much such an export tax would raise annually? And were it to come to pass, would the suggestion of a sole port of export still be on the agenda as gazetted in December the year before last? Then moving on to slide 22 on the subject of the Fourth Industrial Revolution, you mention having taken part in deliberations with a parliamentary joint committee on the subject. I was just curious to know something of the history of that particular parliamentary committee, what its mandate is, and how its recommendations would filter into the work of the executive and shape government policy on the Fourth Industrial Revolution. And then just a broader philosophical question around the Fourth Industrial Revolution and what impact it's going to have in South Africa. You know, is it likely to disrupt or entrench the economic hierarchy that we have in this country? What is its likely impact going to be on our very high levels of inequality? One would assume that there is a danger that the Fourth Industrial Revolution might in fact exacerbate the existing situation. And in that regard, I wonder if the Minister could tell us more about the government's plans to mitigate the effects of the Fourth Industrial Revolution on poverty and inequality, and what is being done to ensure that these issues, insofar as they touch on the Fourth Industrial Revolution, aren't dealt with by government in silos. So how is a joined-up collaborative effort being institutionalised within government to tackle the Fourth Industrial Revolution, and what is EDD's role therein? Then thirdly, staying with the subject broadly of the Fourth Industrial Revolution, I know the Minister will recall that this portfolio committee engaged with Professor Kit Vaughan and Cape Ray about 2 years ago, and at the time, Professor Vaughan had proposed supplying 10 of his cutting-edge breast screening systems to public clinics in areas like Khayelitsha and Alexandra. I just wanted to make sure that it hasn't fallen off the radar, and perhaps whether you could give us an update on EDD's involvement in helping facilitate that. Then on to the second quarter report and the investment conference. You gave us lots of interesting facts and figures. One of the things that you said at the investment conference was that SA has the capacity to build its own trains and needed quite strongly to shift manufacturing from its current share of GDP at 12% to around the Chinese level of 28%. What is EDD doing to improve the capacity to manufacture train sets in South Africa, in collaboration with other line function departments? And then finally, on slide 85 in the presentation, I don't think you got around to discussing it in your oral presentation, but you talk about the Youth Employment Accord And there's a suggestion on slide 85 that there be a single implementation structure, I presume you mean for the Youth Employment Accord itself. What would that single implementation structure look like? Where would it be situated in government? And what is happening to make sure that it comes about? Thank you.
Honourable Chairman.
Thank you very much, Chair. Let me start by just appreciating the kind of work that is being put in here by the ministry. You know, as people who do oversight, sometimes it's very easy for us all the time to, you know, poke holes and all of that because we are on the outside. But if you assess the work that is done in quarter one and quarter two, it gives you an idea about the kind of hard work that is being done here. And as we ask these questions, it's important for us also to acknowledge, you know, this good work that is being done here. A few questions here, Honorable Minister. The first one relates to the business that we are doing with Botswana. My interest is mostly on medicines. We all know that you know, India is taking the lead in that particular area because it has a huge population of over 1 billion and so on. So for them, when they produce, you know, big numbers, and it's easy for them to get the prices down. Now, Honorable Minister, taking into account the fact that there is this new arrangement, the environment of the BRICS, and India is our partner in BRICS, at the background, I want us also to consider the issue of the national health insurance. We're going to need lots and lots of medicines, pharmacies, and so on. Have you ever thought about the possibility of selling an idea, Minister, to government, not just government, but the private sector as well, so that while Aspen and the others continue to compete at that level, but at state level, we consider some kind of partnership with India, both at public and at private level, so that we start producing some companies and so on around the question of medicine and pharmacies to improve both our situation and the situation in the region. I'm just saying, have you ever thought about something like that? Because competing with India around the question of medicines is something that is going to go for a very long time. And I don't see us beating them immediately, but I think we should be considering partnering them in some projects going forward. That is the first the question, just an inquiry. The second question relates to the contraction that has happened during the first quarter and also proceeded towards the second quarter as well. Can you... If you don't really refer to figures per se, can you just generally tell us, Minister, what the comparisons are? As these contractions are happening in South Africa and so on, can you compare us to some of the developing countries in the world, but also to some of the developed countries as well? So that as we're having these problems here, what is the situation in other parts of the world? So that as we look for solutions, we look for solutions, but in a practical way. The third question is just a small inquiry on the aspect of labor brokering. Where are we as the country presently on that matter? Because we've had it on the agenda for quite a long time, and you know, the labor movement has raised several questions and issues around this matter, and I think some time ago certain decisions were taken by government, but I'm just not sure where we are at the moment, if you could just remind us. And during the BRICS summit, Minister, you indicated that there was a special session for African countries on the sidelines. Can you just perhaps indicate to us what were the issues, which countries actually participated, even though not all of them, but the main countries that participated, and what were the issues that were discussed? And what is the potential impact of what was agreed upon, the potential impact on the region and on the continent as well? And finally, on the support for tourism, some years ago, one of the attractions in the Northern Cape, Honorable Minister, was that old mine, the Big Hole there, Big Hole in Kimberley. When people went to the Northern Cape, they would go to that hole. I don't hear much being said about it. Can you just tell us what is going on with it? Has it lost its touch, or is it just being under-marketed? That will be my last question. And once more, thanks for all the good work that you are putting in, Mr. Minister. Thank you.
Honorable Pignani.
Thank you very much. Chair, really welcome the report. We know this department always come with good interventions. You will find out that during recession time, you came with EPUB, which resuscitated, you know, somehow trying to assist us. Mine is a simple one. I think in South Africa is only two quarters that create what you call a recession, Tengah recession. Can you please maybe take us through in terms of the GDP? I'm sure it takes now taking place more than two quarters. It takes two years. Consecutive quarters now. Our situation we find ourselves in South Africa. Now, if you wish to, you can link it with the graph 8. It is in graph 4 and graph 8. If you can link that with those two, I think it will help a bit. To me, it's clear, but I'm saying it's for interest sake, it's very good if you can do that, because you went in depth on it. Thank you very much.
Yeah,
that's the only one.
Thank you very much, Chair. Let me also join my colleagues and welcome the two presentations. My focus is on on quarter two, on KP116, on Township Entrepreneurs, the CFI for cooperatives. I haven't seen such in my province. Maybe if I can be enlightened, where are they situated? Because most of cooperatives are in the deep rural. That's where I come from. But they always ask about their assistance. Now, if we've got this, where are they situated in province, so that we be able to direct them? On the issue of oversighting the entities, the engagement with IDC ministers, since the CEO has resigned, the process of employing one to avoid explanations in future, how far are we in terms of filling the post? And the last one, I just needed clarity here, Minister. The issue of mad meat brewing. The mad meat brewing is on slide 115. On agro-processing, the new, the startup, the company that has received, you say it's a startup. But as I check Mad Meat, it's Soweto Gold. Or am I mixing the two? maybe if I can be clarified on that too, is it a startup or it's further funding, second or what, or these are two different companies, if I can be clarified on that. Thank you very much.
Thanks very much, Acting Chair. Minister, I just wanted to clear up what looks like it could be a little bit of a discrepancy in numbers. It's in the second report. It relates to your slides in Ethiopia, and it's slide number 64 and 65. Under the key RSA exports to Ethiopia in Rand Billion 2017, we've got trucks as number one at 204.7 billion Rand, as far as I understand. But on the next slide, it tells us that we are the ninth supplier of trucks after China, Japan, Italy, Spain, etc. And the imported value of trucks from South Africa is 59 million Rand. So there just seems to be a discrepancy between that value in slide 65, where the value of our truck exports to Ethiopia appears to be 59 million Rand, but we say that it's actually 204.7 billion Rand, which is quite a large discrepancy between the two. The other question I wanted to ask you is, in your first presentation, when we referred to unemployment, we spoke about private households, and private households seem to be one of the areas where we were losing jobs, the most significant loss of jobs. And I'd just like to ask you, what defines private households? What exactly does that mean? And then thirdly, it's the whole issue about, I suppose, aligning the National Department of Economic Development with provincial departments and city departments. I know that as National Assembly we have oversight, obviously, over the National Department, and I would presume the NCOP has oversight over the provincial departments. But I was just wondering, what sort of relationship do you have with the provincial economic development departments? Because I think there's quite a lot of money if we consider all the provincial budgets and the national budgets. And are we all aligned in the same direction? So, in other words, are we using all our resources in a kind of joined up way to try and progress economic development in the country? And the other thing is, I think a lot of people have spoken about with the urbanization of South Africa, with the fact that we will quite soon be in a situation where 70% of our people will be living in the urban areas. There's a feeling that that a lot of the economic development and the creation of jobs will be through city-led growth. And I was just wondering whether you have any plan to interact with the cities and to look at that whole issue of city-led growth and how the major metropolitan areas should be driving the increase of jobs. Finally, I think I might have forgotten my final question. I'll just leave it at that for the time being. Thank you.
Thanks. Let's ask the Minister to respond.
Well, thank you very much. thank you very much, Chair, and thank you to the members for the comments that were made. On the questions that were raised, let me start with the questions raised by Honourable Cardo. Honourable Cardo, the amount of tax that would be raised through an export tax would be principally a function of the level of the tax. So you'd have to set it at the rate. So if you set it at 10% of value, it would be half of if it's set at 20% of value. So that kind of discussion is not yet close to completion, and of course, any of those kind of things would only be announced by the Minister of Finance in a formal budget. But I think it is worth stating that the principal purpose of an export tax would not be revenue raising in an instance like this. It would be to see whether one could find a more efficient system of encouraging the local utilization of scrap. And a useful byproduct would be the revenue raising impact of it. So that would probably influence the level at which a tax was set, if indeed we finalize the tax in this period. If we go the route of an export tax, it may make some of the proposals that ITAC had put up for public comment less necessary, but it does seem to me that we will probably have to re-look our entire approach to the control of scrap metal. On the one hand, there are the localization issues that we've dealt with, but on the other hand, and in addition to that, the big challenge we face now is theft of metal and copper through the public infrastructure program. The City of Cape Town and the Western Cape government has noted repeatedly the problems on PRASA with the theft of cable. The province of Gauteng has raised the challenge with the Gautrain itself for the theft of copper. Hospitals have been affected by it. And so there's been a significant public damage as a result of theft of copper and metal. And so we are seeking to address two separate challenges. They may have some connection with each other, but they certainly down to ensuring a much tighter regulation of the scrap metal trade, whether it's for domestic purposes or for exports for that matter. So I would not be able to indicate whether some or all of the provisions in the Gazette that ITAC has put out would become redundant as a result of the export tax. It would be a function, I think in part, of the control systems that National Treasury puts in place around an export tax. But I emphasize, obviously, that the export tax would deal specifically with one element of the challenge, localization. We still sit with the other challenge, which is the large theft of cable and metal from our public infrastructure system. If we move next to the Fourth Industrial Revolution Parliamentary Committee, in fact, Honorable Cardo, it's my understanding, and I'm going to skate on a little bit of thin ice because I must make some assumptions. It's my sense that this is a joint committee in Parliament of the National Assembly and the NCOP to give Parliament a more significant sense of the challenges that the Fourth Industrial Revolution poses, both for Parliament as an institution, and by the way, the opportunities that it unlocks, but also for parliamentary committees in their oversight work of government departments. So it's not intended, as I understand it, to be a committee that will act in its own name. It's a committee that I think is intended to familiarize other portfolio committees and select committees of the issues that arises, but it would bring to parliamentary staff also a sense of how one can restructure the work of Parliament given the new technologies. The Portfolio Committee on Economic Development and two or three others have been fortunate that as a result of the nature of the interest of the members of the committee and the reports that we've tabled, the Fourth Industrial Revolution has surfaced here. But they really should surface on every portfolio committee's agenda, whether it's police or water or education. It should be a standard item on portfolio committee agendas. And I think that the presiding officers see that, and so they want to deepen awareness about it. The second part of it is Parliament itself. So I recall in 2010, when the new growth path was adopted, I had to do a presentation to Parliament on it, to the Portfolio Committee. But I was unavoidably stuck in Gauteng. And we made an arrangement at the time to do a video conference with a committee. And it worked absolutely well. And that was, if you think about it, it's almost 10 years ago. And it's not become the norm in Parliament to use video conference technologies. And that's just one small example or illustration of the kind of things that Parliament may want to think about and see how it can patch heads of agencies much quicker into parliamentary committees, so that there's more real-time interaction, but also that instead of the enormous investment of time when someone comes to Cape Town, they could spend the 2 hours or the 1 hour accounting to the committee and then the rest of the time also implementing. So you can have efficiency-inducing systems that actually enhances democracy, because accountability is critical in a democratic system. And if one waits 3 weeks or 4 weeks before someone's diary can be aligned with Parliament, then the ability of Parliament to play its oversight role is reduced, is diminished. So I think it's those kind of issues that that joint committee is trying to grapple with. Moving on to the interesting question that was asked on the impact of the Fourth Industrial Revolution on the economy, the South African economy, I would start by saying that the one standard feature of the technology is that it is disruptive. It disrupts. It's its nature, it's potentially its strength, it's potentially the price that society pays. But what it disrupts and what it creates in its wake, we can influence to some extent. So I want to give an example of income inequality, or let's just say broader inequalities in the society. We've got two roads with the Fourth Industrial Revolution. The one road is a road in which it deepens the existing inequalities, and the other road is where it helps to make the economy more inclusive and more available to people. Public policy influences those routes. So if data costs remain high, as an illustration, and data is your passport to the Fourth Industrial Revolution, then it may exclude smaller businesses, young people, new entrants from using the enormous resources that can come from being online. If, on the other hand, data costs were competitively priced and were affordable, then you empower many more people to access those services. The one route is a route of deepening your income inequalities. The other route is one of improving the inequalities, moderating them, reducing them. So public policy has to think through where it intervenes, how it intervenes, and what are the smart tools available. The old regulation, where you seek to regulate everything in considerable detail, doesn't work as well in the 21st century. You need a lighter touch, smart regulation, perhaps things that look more at outcomes than inputs. So there's quite a challenge that I think the regulators and the lawmakers will have to think through what is the appropriate regulatory regime that will encourage. So if you simply mandate lower prices, and the result of just simply mandating it, putting it in your law, is that you come below the economic cost of the production of infrastructure for data, people just won't invest. So in theory, you'll have a low price. In practice, you will have no availability. If you leave it purely unregulated and you leave it to market forces, the tendency would be for the big players to consolidate themselves. First mover advantage to a big player would mean they entrench themselves, and no one else can come in because they've got in first, they've been able to amortize their infrastructure, and no one else can meet the cost of putting in new infrastructure. And an example like that. What the regulator may decide is to always ensure that you have two or three big players in the market, that they compete with each other, so you've got to watch out for collusion and those kind of things, and let the power of competition energize the economy. So there's an illustration of opportunity. So let me come back then to your question. The question is, will the Fourth Industrial Revolution deepen inequalities in the South African economy? The answer must be, it depends on what we do. If we follow the wrong policies, it can in fact deepen inequality. If we follow the right policies, it can give smaller businesses and young people access and allow them to compete more effectively with big players. In the break that we had earlier, I was sharing with Honorable Atkinson the example of the discussion with Jack Ma. So he's created this platform, and as he sees it, that platform empowers small businesses more than anyone else, because larger businesses, if you make, let's say, this book and you're a very large business, you have the resources to get to market. You can get your book to the market and people can then buy it if they like it. If you're a small player and you make this, you don't have the resources to get it to the market. You don't supply it in enough quantities, perhaps, for Shoprite Checkers to be interested in it. You don't have a long record that they can base their decision to buy from you. But if you have these online platforms and you put your book, even if you can only produce 50 of it, no big retailer would be interested in 50. But if you do 50 online and you sell those 50 and you use the income to increase your print run to 100, 150, 200, you get into the market. So that's the potential of the new technology. But equally, that new technology can, if it's too costly for new players, it can act as a barrier, as a closed shop for the existing players. How are we using it to mitigate poverty and inequality? Well, part of the what we're doing with online systems is if we can bring services to more parts of the country. Let me go back to what I've indicated as the Sutherland example. Small little town, deep poverty, very high abuse of alcohol, lots of drugs among young people, basically a place that feels hopeless. Now, if one can get young people there, I recently, when I went to Sutherland, I also opened officially a early childhood development center that we had managed to find a corporate sponsor to upgrade after my last visit. Now, if we can get those young people to have access to the internet, we bring them into the 21st century economy quickly. But you will recall what I indicated was the challenge with getting company registrations done. Now, if we can get those young people to be familiar with the internet, unlike their parents who are not familiar with it, they can catapult immediately to access the same resources that a child in Cape Town or a child in Johannesburg has, or in fact a child in New York City for that matter. So I'm an optimist on technology. And as an optimist about technology, even though it's disruptive to society, the level of negative disruption can be reduced if we, as policymakers, as lawmakers, and as regulators, think through a smart policy regime. And so in that context, what the President has asked us to do is to put up a digital economy commission. Minister Kwele is leading government's work on the digital economy commission, but that commission would bring across different government entities, everybody in one room, in one forum, to see how we can activate the power of the fourth industrial revolution to do more things and better things for the country. So that's really where we're at on joined up government on the fourth industrial revolution. On the issues that's come up around Professor Vaughan, I can check the latest with Cape Ray, but essentially they're still in trial stage where they've increased the size of the trial, so it's a human trial now, and I'm sure as the results of that come out, usable machines would arise from it. So at the moment, still in test prototype. It's not yet in commercial production. The next issue that was raised was on quarter two, the capacity to build trains. And I would make the point, Honorable Carter, that we already have a significant train-making capability in the Transnet rail engineering factories dotted across the country. And therefore it was unusual for South Africa to have to import the number of trains that was done a few years ago, because we have that capability in South Africa. And recently the President and the Minister of Transport launched in Kudaspoort a private sector initiative to expand South Africa's train making capability. So between Transnet and this private sector initiative, we now have an even larger train making capability. In Score Metals, we've got the capability to make some of the components like the wheels that go into the trains. In Highveld Steel, we have the capability now to make the tracks that the trains can go on. And in the African Union, South Africa was given the right to be, the designation to be Africa's train-producing center. Now it needs us to refocus our diplomacy on the continent to get more trains and rails purchased from South Africa and to expand our capability. What are we then doing as EDD? We've started a discussion with Minister Gordon and Transnet, with Minister Gordon, with the intention that eventually we can get Transnet and the IDC to work much more closely together to make South Africa the preferred source for trains across the continent. Who do we compete with? We'd compete, among others, with the Chinese and perhaps to some extent with the Europeans. And what we've seen with the competition is that they often don't go in just with train-making capabilities. They go in with a package. It would be a finance package, a maintenance package, and a train procurement package. And so South Africa hasn't developed those kind of let's call it connected packages that makes it possible for a country to see us as their preferred supplier. I raised this idea with the commercial banks earlier this year to say that part of what they can do as corporate South Africa, the finance sector, is help to put these packages together so that a South African company that's operating elsewhere in the continent puts an entire package up. On the slide 85 proposal, I'm going to ask Deputy Minister to speak to the youth single structure. And perhaps I should ask Deputy Minister to respond to that in any of the other areas that he would like to respond to, and then I can deal with the remainder of the issues before I go to Honourable Kiani Pikinini and Matsimbi's questions.
Thanks, Minister. It was on the Youth Employment Accord when in the observation it was said that we need to have a single implementation, maybe we need to have a single implementation structure. It's not a single implementation structure as in like a structure, it's more of a single coordinating, a structure that will form a single coordination point for the work done by private sector, by labor, and also by the social structure, because it was seen to be missing, because in government itself, EDD would easily coordinate different departments and be able to get a lot of information. But then if you want now to go into the companies and go down their areas, you wouldn't have a point where you're actually referring to. So the observation was that it looked like you need this coordination point that is agreed by the different players that will allow you to have to be able to source out information in the different areas. This notion has already been incorporated in other initiatives. For instance, in the YES initiative, they actually took this idea and actually put it there. And also in the Job Summit discussion now, there's also a suggestion like that that says, if we have to improve coordination amongst ourselves,
we need to then create a coordination a center. On our side as government, in terms of intersphere, because in province, some of the work is actually done in provinces, is that we would be establishing an institute, a system, an economic, what we call provincial economic council, where we have all of them actually coordinating a part of government. And the other one that that has got to do with the other partners is something that we're going to be selling when cabinet has already agreed with us. On the other matters that the other matter that I would like to talk to is in relation to the work that we do with the provinces, and in terms of how do we ensure that the provinces are actually the resources are actually consolidated to respond to the challenges that we have in the country. It's work in progress, and one of the things that are actually coming out is that because provinces have got a lot of challenges in their budget, you will see that they are more skewed towards other areas of work. And even when they have actually put in resources in the for economic development, it's like isolated projects that are not consolidated into one to give us more traction. And it's work that we're actually engaged on, and part of the initiative that have been indicated here using the investment congress conference, using the job summit as a tool to actually try to align ourselves is the one that we'll see when the outcome that it will actually give us at a later stage.
Through your chair, thank you very much to the Deputy Minister. On as I go to the next one, I should just say to Honourable Cardo, taking the break, I've just asked if we could get a bit more details on the Cape Ray position. And the one additional bit of information that's come out is that on the upside, Cape Ray has sold one of its prototypes machines now to Germany, so hopefully this will help to extend the clinical trials further to another jurisdiction with another partner there. And I'm also told that the offer on Khayelitsha was that government should buy the prototype and utilize it in the meantime. And the national department indicated this should be done by the provincial department. In other words, a story that we've heard many times between spheres of government. So I think we need to just, as a matter of interest, follow this up. Obviously, we can't compel, but because it's not free of charge, we've got to try to encourage. I think, though, once the machine has gone through all of its clinical trials and it's proven to be capable of giving us the benefits, then we can begin to look at requiring it to be one of the projects that we designate. In other words, where public institutions may be required to buy this if it's cheaper, as let's call it a preferred technology. So instead of having two machines, a scanner and an X-ray, you can now get both of them and you can roll them out in rural areas, you can make them available more generally. But it's a good prompt that we should just follow up on this one. Turning next to Honorable Triani's points, an interesting issue around India and Botswana and medicine. So we already a big producer of generic medication through Aspen, but also through a few other players that are here. Aspen, of course, is a South African company, very large, actually, one of our largest companies, and quite successful, not just in South Africa, but in a number of other markets. India has got an enormous focus on pharmaceuticals, whereas China grew a lot of its exports off the back of clothing, electronics, and toys in the early days. India is really focusing on medication. The we have had expressions of interest from Indian companies to locate in South Africa. But India, of course, also pursues its own interest. And given their need to industrialize, their incentive structures and their focus is to create these massive factories in India that exports to the rest of the world. So I have no doubt that there is opportunity, as you indicate, Honorable Kiani, for us to talk further with Indian companies. But here's the issue that we find in any economic alliance, including BRICS. We've got common interests and we've got competing interests. And we need to, where there are common interests, we can, as they say, march together. But where there are competing interests, whether it is India or whether it's China, we as South Africans have to pursue our interests, and they as Chinese and Indians will pursue their interests. So I will find out what has been done by different agencies to interact with the Indian pharmaceutical industry and see is there potential and opportunity there for us. And if there is, we should grab it. But I would also put the caution that even among friends, in a friendly relationship, there's also competition. And India is very anxious to industrialize. And even though its growth rates are high at the moment, levels of poverty in India also, of course, are deep. And they've got hundreds of millions of people living in poverty. So they're going to focus on trying to find opportunities to bring those people into employment in India, selling medication to the rest of the world. So it's that balance. Let's stretch out to them, see is there opportunity, but also let's build South African companies. If Aspen is successful, how do we get the next Aspen to operate? How do we use our state procurement to help build South African knowledge and capability in pharmaceuticals? In medication, basically. So I wasn't aware of India's significant increase of market share in Botswana until I looked at the trade data. So it's something that we now can talk to Aspen about and say what's happening there, how come India's able to undercut, what kind of drugs are they able to produce more cheaply. It's that conversation we can begin to have. On the contraction compared to developed and developing countries, honorable members will recall about two and a half, perhaps 3 years ago, there was a deep shrinking in the Brazilian economy. They went into a quite significant recession, as did Russia. Canadian economic performance was also down, and that was the result of the commodity cycle that minerals, gas, oil, had powered these economies quite strongly. And as prices went down and demand went down, those economies were dragged down. South Africa then avoided the recession at that time. And we avoided it mainly because of our infrastructure spending. As infrastructure spending came down over the last 2 years, 1.5, 2 years, the economy's performance also went down. And infrastructure spending went down, among others, not the only reason, but one of the big reasons, was the weaknesses in state-owned companies. They are big drivers of infrastructure spending, Transnet, Eskom, Sunrail. In the case of Sunrail, it went down principally because of the funding model, the ETOLs. In the case of Eskom and Transnet, there is very definitely credible evidence that state capture and corruption contributed to bad decision-making by boards and CEOs, overpayment, we think, in some cases, the various investigations will show the extent of it, and the cleanup that government has done now will hopefully help those state-owned companies to emerge able again to drive infrastructure investment. But we've lost time and we've lost opportunity as a result of that. And that, again, underlines that issues of corruption are not only moral issues, they're also economic issues. You You shoot your own economy in the foot when decisions are made on improper motives. On labor brokers, Parliament passed legislation that deals with security of employment. Now, a labor broker, very often, let's say you run a business and you're unhappy with the wages, working conditions, or security of employment of workers, and you contract a labor broker to do it for you, you basically shift the responsibility to the labor broker. So Parliament passed laws to deal with employment security, bringing in the idea that you can't stay in a permanent contractual relationship where your contract is renewed once a year permanently, that can't be a contractual right that an employer has towards an employee. Following that, I think it was in July this year, we're now in November, it's about July this year, there was an important constitutional court case that where the courts held that a temporary contract could not be rolled over indefinitely. So if we take both the legislative intervention and the jurisprudence, meaning the results of the court processes, I think there's a weaker economic incentive for companies to rely on labor broking, because the courts essentially say ultimately the ultimate contractor, meaning the company that employs the labor broker, can't escape liability by employing a labor broker. It is ultimately jointly liable for employment, working conditions, security of jobs, and so on. So I think it may be that we would see a reduction in labor broking. That's one likely outcome of the combination of statute and court judgment. But as with these things, they take a bit of time for it to manifest itself. But labor brokers, I think, are finding that the terrain is a more difficult terrain than it was previously. And I hope that gives Honorable Tlhane a bit of a sense. I can try to get a little bit more update on the numbers. I think we should see by next year whether it's impacted on labor broking numbers. You won't see it immediately in the numbers, but over time we ought to be able to see a trend line. On BRICS and Africa, we had invited basically the heads of all of the regional economic entities, so COMESA, the East Africa community, the West Africa community, and we had also invited the key leadership in the African Union. It's on the rotation, so the countries that were in leadership in the African Union in that period when we had the BRICS summit, we had invited them, and some of the countries that played leading roles, for example, in infrastructure on the continent, we had invited them. So it was not an attempt to bring all 54 heads of state here. It would have been too large a meeting, but it was at least representatives from every part of the continent. And the conversation was, how do we build a stronger relationship between BRICS and the continent? What can BRICS countries do to boost investment to the African continent? And what can they do to help boost industrialization on the continent? Instead of seeing Africa as a market where they sell goods, how can we get them to see Africa as a place where they produce goods? So it was that kind of conversation. And the other part of the conversation was investment in infrastructure. So based on that, one of the BRICS countries, the BRICS country with the largest economy, China, about a month or so after the BRICS summit, convened a meeting in China of all 54 African countries and the Chinese leadership. It's called FOCAC. It's the Forum on China-Africa Cooperation. And they talked about how China, in that case, can relate to the continent. I underline with all of these that it doesn't matter which country we deal with and however friendly we are with countries, we have to, like, watch our own interests and ensure that we protect the national interests and the sovereign interests and the continent's interests. And the African Free Trade Area is an attempt to do exactly that. What we're saying is, yes, BRICS is important, but it's even more important that we trade with each other as Africans and that we buy and sell from each other. And so when we signed the Free Trade Agreement and it was sent to Parliament for ratification, it was really saying our priority, our very first relationship is with our own continent. And then we have all these other friendly relationships with the rest of the world. But it's building Africa as a free trade area, as a common market, as a place that we get investment flowing more easily and we have goods flowing more easily. That's where our principal focus is. So Africa can then speak, hopefully with a single voice, to BRICS countries. South Africa, much as we have friendly relations, we're the smallest player in BRICS in size of economy, size of population, and so on. So we need to muscle up, bulk up. And we can only bulk up by our relationships in the African continent. Moving on to the final question on the big hole in Kimberley. Now, I think I should indicate in our relationship with the tourism department, they will take the lead in developing a complete portfolio of projects that they want to lift the tourism profile of. And as I understand it, they're working currently on a master plan, a tourism master plan, that they will complete early in the new year, that is intended to bring all the different key projects in. So we would certainly bring in, among others, we'll suggest to them that they look at the big hole. I've been there in Kimberley, and the truth is, if you are going to Kimberley, you're going to look at the big hole. But you're unlikely to go to Kimberley to look at the big hole. In other words, it's not a compelling enough reason to go from Joburg to Kimberley just to see a very large hole. So what one needs to think about is there a bigger storyline around Kimberley, of which the big hole is one element? On its own, can't work. With another broader storyline, it can work. So one of the examples that I gave in the presentation was astrotourism. Now, astrotourism, in Sutherland, they've got one of the world's biggest telescopes. It's a massive telescope. It can see far into the universe. Now, of course, you can't actually look at, through it. It's too big. It's a massive thing that everything is through computer screens. And not very far, a couple hours further, is Carnarvon, where we're building the world's biggest radio telescope. So the one is optic, it means you see through your eyes. The other one is radio, they look for signals, and they convert the signals to an image. It's not very far from Cape Town. And yet very few Cape Townians have been there. And I asked them how many tourists have come, and it's actually a relatively small number of tourists who come there. And yet not far from Cape Town. And it's not well marketed. If you go to New York, or you go to London, or you go to Beijing, they package their tourism attractions so well that at the point when you're going to visit that city, you know all the other places you can go to. We haven't taken astronomy as a tourism attraction. On its own, Sutherland may not do it. Together with Carnarvon, together with the fact that not very far from there, you also have these early human settlements and evidence of early human life, if you can package all of that together, it makes it worthwhile for people to go out of the way. So I don't know if there's an economic case for Kimberley specifically to invest in there, but I think the fact that they now have a university that's being built, that we creating at least an intellectual infrastructure, makes it a slightly more attractive place. So that's, I think, what one is looking for. We can't make the decision what goes into the master plan, but we can say to the Department of Tourism, have you looked at Kimberley carefully? Have you made sure that we build a storyline around all of that? And in the end, private investors will have to pay for this. And they'll only pay if they can see, look, there is a storyline that will make someone want to come from Germany, fly to Joburg, and go to Kimberley. And if there isn't a storyline, they're not going to invest in it. And so I hope that, that helps a little bit to explain that. On Honorable Piccinini's question, the two quarters of economic decline, Honorable Piccinini, I think you're right. I'm trying to make sure I can look at you while this column is in the way. But you're right that one has to look to genuinely get a sense of where the economy is going. You want to look at a 1 or 2 year trend line. There's good news and there's bad news. The good news, as I showed with the 50-year trend line, is that the South African economy has actually gone through a very long period without a recession, the second longest period in that 50-year period. That's the good news. The bad news is when it grew, it didn't grow fast enough to meet the requirements of a growing population and expectations of young people for more jobs, more economic opportunity, and so on. So we've got to up the rate of growth. And that's why when economists pointed out it was a technical recession, meaning by textbook standards it's a recession, we took the view that we're not going to focus on the technical side. We're going to focus on the fact we are in recession and we need a stimulus package and a recovery plan, and we need to get on with lifting the rate of growth. If we had avoided the recession, we would still not be in a great space because the rate of growth is still too low. So if we're going to lift the trend line of growth, there's a few things we need to do, and some of them we're beginning to do. The first thing is you've got to fight corruption. If corruption just distorts resources, so there's a lot that we're now doing to rein back corruption and deal with state capture. The second thing is you've got to deal with improving a climate for investors to bring money in. So take an investor in tourism. They'll only invest if they know tourists will come. Tourists will only come if your visa regime makes it relatively easy for them to come. If you've got to fill in lots of forms and you've got to have a bridge birth certificate that says who was your mom and your dad and your grandfather and your grandmother and so on, you just think, you know, why do I go to that country? Let me just go to another country where the visa is easier. Even though South Africa is an incredibly beautiful country, you know, if you have an easy visa regime, people would want to come here. But if you make it too difficult for them, they're not going to come here. A third example of what you need to grow is you need to be able to embrace the 21st century technologies. It's coming back to Honorable Cardo's earlier question. So how do you bring South Africa into the 21st century across different platforms? Part of it is we must release more spectrum in the market. Spectrum is like the oxygen that big data companies use. If I use my cell phone, 20 years ago I used it to make phone calls. Then a couple of years later I began to use it much more for data, to send emails and so on. Today people use it much more for, they're downloading video much more. It's not now messages to each other, it's pictures and video. Now each of these require a lot more technical platforms to be able to run on, and spectrum is one of those technical platforms that's available. And so as we migrate from analog TV, the old way in which television is broadcast, which we still use, to digital, we also release more spectrum. So when SABC transmit on SABC 1, the image, at the moment it takes a lot of spectrum. As we move it to digital, we release a little bit. So we've now put into the market what we're doing on digital release of spectrum. If you want people to invest in mining, they must know if they're going to bring R1 billion or R10 billion or R50 billion into a mine, what is the legal and policy rules that apply? We call it the legal regime. Now, if there's a long period of debate about a mining charter, people are not going to invest. They're going to wait until you make up your mind on the mining charter, because they need to see, will that mining charter still make it profitable for them to invest? So these are the kind of things we've now begun to do as government. So we're no longer talking about doing it. We've done it. We've published the mining charter. We've indicated the policy for release of spectrum. We've changed the visa rules and so on. So hopefully we can now see this will now begin to come through the system, and eventually it should lead to a stronger growth rate. Honorable Matsimbi's questions. The first question that Honorable Matsimbi asked about is where the corporate financial institutions are situated and where they work. First, the department itself works with National Treasury, and I'm going to suggest, Honorable Matsimbi, that the department links up with you to ensure that you're able to access for the area that you have as your constituency access to these things. But corporate and financial institutions are situated, there are 27 of them at the moment, and they're in just about every province. In fact, the province with the biggest number is Gauteng, but Limpopo has 6 of them, KZN is about 5 of them, Western Cape has 3, Free State, Eastern Cape and Northwest East have 1. So this is not an area, obviously, that EDD drives. We just try to facilitate. So if I may ask then, perhaps, if the department could follow up with Honorable Matsimbi on the corporate financial institutions. On the IDC, the CEO process is underway at the moment. We've advertised, the board has put together a subcommittee, they've working with the headhunting agency, they are in the process of identifying, they're engaging with the executive. So as soon as we complete the entire process, we will then be able to make an announcement on that one. On the slide dealing with Mad Meat Brewing, I will follow up on this, but this fund was started, the Pioneer Bread Cartel was in 2010, we set up the Agro-Processing Competitiveness Fund probably in 2011, and it began to operate in 2012. So it wouldn't be, all of these are not things that we're doing immediately now. It's over a number of years that we've put this together. So what we wanted to see is how well they're functioning. Have we used the 250 million rand? And the answer is yes. In fact, we've used more than 250 million rand because we used interest income from the money and reflows, meaning we lend you the money, you pay us back, we can lend it to someone else again. So we've actually used more than 300 million of that original sum. I'll find out about this particular company and let Honorable Member know about it. On Ethiopia, the question that was come that was raised there, the discrepancy in the data on trucks. Well, Honorable Atkinson, I should make the point that we use two sources to get the data. So it's not a typing error. It's a challenge that I should perhaps open up and let the committee know. South Africa publishes its export data. Country X, let's say United States, Ethiopia, China, publishes their import data. Sometimes these two data sets don't match. We may say we export 50 million to Ethiopia. Ethiopia may say they import 100 million from us. Whose figure do you use? Now, there will always be a small discrepancy. So think about it. If I make this mobile phone in China and it's worth, let's say, 1,000 rand, and I export it to South Africa, my data will say I'm exporting 1,000 rand. Now, on that you must add the price of shipping it and the price of insurance and those kind of things. And when it landed, it may be 1,100 rand. So South Africa will declare it as 1,100 rand. Those are acceptable parameters. In our trade data, though, the problems are not that. We have massive mismatches between the data we collect and the data that other people declare. And we've raised this with SARS, and the task team on illegal imports is looking at this. Often, South African importers will suppress the value of the imports. Sometimes South African exporters will exaggerate the value of the exports because it's a way of getting money out of the country. So you have all of those problems inherent in your trade data. So for us, trade data is useful in showing broad trends rather than precise numbers that you can absolutely bet the farm on. So this is what they call a mirror data problem, meaning on the one side, the number is whatever the level is that we put in there. On the other side, the number is much higher or much lower. In both of them, they show that we're still a reasonably significant truck exporter, but obviously if we use the South African mirror data, we're a bigger truck exporter. So we've gone to two different sources. Our data won't show where Ethiopia buys the rest of their products, so we can't use our data for that. So we use Ethiopian data for that. Our data will show only what South African exporters are declaring from here. I know it sounds very messy. It's the nature of trade data across the world. And we've raised the issue whether our problem isn't even more intense than other countries. All countries face a degree of this problem in using trade data. So two sources giving you two different numbers for this. Private households would be people that an individual employ in their own home. It's typically domestic workers and sometimes people who work in as gardeners. Again, an interesting thing is that South Africa's employment of domestic workers or people in what they call household employment is a bigger proportion than many other countries. So it's the nature of the history and so on. And we've seen no clear pattern. It's not as if it's the numbers going down dramatically or going up dramatically. It fluctuates over time. So that's what the category refers to, private households. On the relationship between the Economic Development Department at provincial level and national level, it's what we call a fraternal relationship, meaning there's no tools that's available in the relationship for one to require the other. So we can bring them together, we can talk, we can encourage, but we can't compel. Overall, if I had to look at the period as a whole, deputy ministers led that much of that relationship. And I think he would probably conclude, but he is more, I think, able and more on top of it. But my sense is it's an uneven relationship. In some provinces it works well with national. In other provinces it doesn't work well. And it's not to do with the political complexion of provinces. It has to do very much with an institutional culture in the province. Is the province, is its worldview out, that it looks out to the world and it embraces, or is it fairly focused on working only within the provincial bubble? But I would encourage DM to make any other observation on that. Can we improve the relationship? Absolutely. But it requires that we have either a common willingness to do so, which would have to come from the premiers. They would have to encourage the MECs to do it. It may be that we can create some common tools. Years back, we explored the idea whether one shouldn't fold all development finance institutions into one. Instead of having an IDC and a series of provincial ones, why not create a single one? But leave each province to have a portion of the money available. And let the ribbon cutting be for that province's MEC or premier or so. So that you have, instead of money being utilized in very different directions, you have a more coordinated approach. We haven't taken that idea forward. But I think there may be grounds for us to do it, for it to be done in the new administration. Finally, on my side, city-led growth is critical, absolutely critical. If one looks at what's driving modern economies, it's urban areas. In South Africa, we've got a strong bias in policy that we must support rural areas, and it's important that we do so, because if everybody had to come to cities, the infrastructure would be overrun. The ability to put people in schools and clinics and housing would just be impossible. So we must have a rural strategy. But if you're looking for your long-term growth, it's going to come from cities. And we are becoming, by the year, a more urban society. More than half, a significant portion of the South African population now live in cities and large towns. So we're no longer principally a rural economy, although millions of our people still live in rural areas. But a bigger percentage of our people now live in urban areas. Not always in the best part of an urban area, very often in informal settlements, which we need to upgrade. But the history of economic history of the world has shown that the more urban a society, the wealthier that society. So let's find the balance. Still have a strong focus on the rural areas because that's often where the deepest levels of poverty are. But cities, a city-led initiative where we bring together the big metros with national government to help boost investment and growth is certainly one of the things that we should be doing more of. Often cities have had their own fragile governance arrangement, particularly in the last couple of years, but we need to do more to build a partnership between city and national, because the rural areas also benefit if cities thrive, because cities buy so much of the products that come from rural areas. So what can we do different? Infrastructure. Two kinds of infrastructure, one that links a city much more up with itself, and the other one that links the rural areas better up with the city. The first one is public transport. But it's also we need to relook our housing program. There are not many large developing countries or even developed countries where every person has their own home, has their own house. More and more people live in large blocks of flats. You have densification where you have many more people per square kilometer in a city. You see it in Singapore, you see it in China, in India, in the United States, in London, in Germany. That's where it's going. And so how do we, there's still a strong preference locally for single individual homes, but it's not the global trend. Both developed and developing countries are going for massification in the main urban areas. South Africa hasn't crossed that river yet. Of embracing densification. And densification don't need to mean a lower quality place to live in. If you go, I've gone to Singapore and I've seen their high-rise buildings. including high-rise buildings for high-rise buildings that are available to the poor, to the middle class, and it's often excellent, much better than the kind of RDP houses we build, and cheaper per unit because you have common infrastructure to it. So acting chairperson, as always, we get a bit carried away in the replies, but I wish we had a bit more time, and I hope we have answered the questions that honorable members have put to us. Thank you very much.
Oh, thanks very much, Minister. Let me thank the Minister and the DM and the team for always coming to us prepared, well prepared. You always come well prepared, Minister. And also thank the members for their participation. Our next meeting will be on the 27th with EDD and IDC. We'll be discussing the matters that emanated from the annual reports. Before closing, can I allow the Secretary to make one announcement?
Thank you, Acting Chairperson. Members, just straight to the point, it's the matter of that you would have seen in the program of the committee that next week there was the proposed oversight visit local from the discussions we had with the IDC and the EDD, K9 Good Foods and Sheraton Texas. We are just waiting for the word from the Office of the Health Chairperson, and we will communicate the outcome of that application by the end of the day or tomorrow morning. So the activities of the next week will just be based on that response. Thank you very much.
Thanks. The meeting stands adjourned.